better. Take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week of June 30th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer and more radical info from the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for June 30th. Perhaps the first massive slaughter in the New World. On this day in 1520, Claudio Conquistador Cortez massacres Montezuma and Aztec nobles. Also on this date in 1839, Chin Q successfully organized a mutiny on a slave ship, Amistad, and after much struggle successfully petitions the U.S. court to rule that slaves have the right to fight in mutiny on slave ships. Also on June 30th, 1894, Chicago Tribune headlines describes the events of the Pullman strikes with obvious yellow journalism and anti-union rhetoric. Always venerable, New York Times refers to agitator Eugene Debs as a lawbreaker and an enemy of the human race. Also for June 30th, 1909, a large meeting organized by the Free Speech Society is held in Cooper Union to protest the harassment of anarchist speaker Emma Goldman and to win back the rights of free speech. Eugene Debs is back in the news in this date in 1918 when he is arrested by the Wilson administration for his anti-war involvements. Also on June 30th, 1934 in Germany, the Night of the Long Knives occurs when Hitler stages bloody purge of the Nazi Party. Jews, Unionists, Communists, Gypsies, and Gays to follow. Also on June 30th, 1944, Jerome becomes the first concentration camp for Japanese Americans to close. Also on that date in 1952, let freedom ring. Congress passes McCarran-Walter Immigration Act to screen out, quote, subversive, unquote, aliens and deport them, even if they had become U.S. citizens. Following up on the McCarran Act with the Internal Security Act of 1950, one of the more scary provisions still in the books is being the authorization of concentration camps for when the government declares emergency situations. By the way, as Harry Truman noted, quote, "The idea behind this discriminatory policy is, to put it boldly, that Americans with English and Irish names were better citizens than Americans with Italian, Greek, or Polish names," unquote, while in fact its real motivation was towards excluding non-whites in this aspect. Also on June 30th, 1965, the first U.S. ground actions begin in South Vietnam.
Foreign policy has very little to do with morality, and as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on June 30th, 1971, I Am Not a Crook, Tricky Dick Nixon orders felony burglaries of the Brookings Institute. This comes during a meeting of the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, Defense Secretary Malvin Lard, Attorney General John Mitchell, and Haldeman. Later, this group would propose a firebombing of the building. When this meeting is later exposed, future Nobel Peace Prize winner Henry Kissinger claimed he could not recall what was said in that meeting. Also on June 30, 1986, Georgia sodomy laws upheld by the Supreme Court 5-4 decision. Sodomy, a 1-to-20-year sentence, upheld as to homosexuals on the grounds that there is no fundamental federal constitution right to engage in sodomy. Sodomy laws were given names such as buggery, crimes against nature, sexual misconduct, unnatural sex, etc. Most laws are applied against homosexuals in order to further anti-gay discrimination. Sodomy laws resulted in imprisonment, parents losing custody of children, loss of jobs and homes, beatings, killings, and other atrocities. Sodomy laws are often used to deny basic rights of homosexuals. State-by-state laws were created to patchwork the penalties, which range from $50 fine in Arizona to life imprisonment in Idaho. Remember, you heterosexuals, God only allows a missionary position. Lastly, on June 30th, 1998, Paris, a group of 100 people managed to enter the building of the Constitutional Council. One of them sees the original specimen of the Constitution, tears it up, and declares, "The dictatorship of capitalism is abolished." On this day in radical history for July 1st, Switzerland, conspirator, anarchist, rival to Marx, and assassin of God, Mikhail Bakunin, dies on this date in 1876. Also for July 1st, 1892, Homestead Steel Mill strike begins in Pennsylvania, leading to large-scale battles between workers and anti-labor private police known as the Pinkertons. Also on July 1st, 1922, a 1-million-strong railroad shopmen's labor strike begins. Also on July 1st, 1970, Women Against Daddy Warbucks destroys 1A files and 8 New York City draft boards. Also on July 1st, 1972, I Am Not a Crook, Tricky Dick Nixon is recorded on tape with chief political aide the plotting of the break-in of the Republican National Committee headquarters. This is to divert attention from the Watergate break-ins. Our president is on tape suggesting that Bandle should tear the Republican offices to shambles. Remember, according to Nixon and our current president, anything the president does is legal. Also on July 1st, 1972, the first Rainbow Gathering takes place in Strawberry Lake, Colorado. Also on July 1st, 1977, Native American activist Leonard Peltier is sentenced to 2 life sentences for being somewhere in the general proximity of 2 FBI agents while attacking the American Indian Movement encampment. The FBI had been terrorizing the Lakota Reservation in a COINTELPRO operation for some time prior to the shootout. COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, directed agents to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activist and dissident movement and leaders. The FBI still holds over 6,000 pages which will not release to the Peltier's defense team for they claim that holds national security secrets. This Week in Radical History for July 2nd, 1776. By constitutional statute, New Jersey gives all inhabitants of adult age with a net worth of $50 and residing in the county for 12 months the right to vote. In 1790, someone realized that this meant both men and women. The law was legal until 1807 when the new law limited the vote to free white males. Don't want those uppity women in black voting, do we? Yeah, let's go back to the original Founding Fathers' interpretation of the Constitution, shall we? Also for July 2nd in the Promised Land, not if you're Native American, for on this date in 1872, the second Colville Indian Reservation is created in eastern Washington when white pressure forces original reservation on better lands to be reopened for white non-Native American farmers. Your Promised Land is now kind of over there. No, not there, a little further. No, not by that tree. Over there by those rocks. There you go, you engine. Also for July 2nd, 1881. While waiting for a train at a Washington railway station, President Jimmy Garfield is fatally shot. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Also on July 2, 1945, Charles Collins, a black union organizer, is attacked at the U.S. Capitol by policemen. Also on this date, 1946, blacks get to vote in the Mississippi Democratic primary for the first time. Richard Daniel, a black veteran, is arrested for attempting to register to vote in Mississippi, and then is beaten unconscious. Also for July 2, 1956, 9 injured when 2 explosions destroy a portion of the Sylvania Electronics Products Atomic Research Center in Bayside, Queens. In 1961, Ernest Hemingway, American writer, alleging CIA persecution, Ernest blows his brains out with a shotgun in Ketchum, Idaho. A few years back, a man high up in the CIA named Ray Klein was asked if the CIA, by its surveillance of protest organizations in the United States, was violating the free speech provision of the First Amendment. He smiled and said, "It's only an amendment." And this day in Radical History, 1970, Vietnam, exposure of the tiger cages at Khon San Prison, used by U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government to torture political prisoners. During the Vietnam War, prisoners who had been held at the prison in the 1960s said they were abused and tortured. When U.S. delegation arrived at the prison, they departed from the planned tour, guided by a map drawn out by a former detainee. The map led them to a door of the building. Inside, they found prisoners who were shackled within cramped tiger cages. Prisoners began crying out for water as the delegation walked in. They had sores and bruises, and some were mutilated. A photographer took photos of the scene, and photos were published in Life magazine. Along with the earlier disclosure of the My Lai massacre and later disclosures of the Pentagon Papers, the revelations of the conditions, the purpose of the Khon San Island prisons led to more Americans to believe that supporting the South Vietnamese government was improper and they should oppose the war. Nah, like President Bush said, the U.S. doesn't torture people. This Week in Radical History for July 3rd, 1607 in the New World. Indians bring maize, beans, squash, fish, and smoked meats to the Jamestown colony. As with Plymouth years later, the colonists and their diseases would eventually kill all the Native Americans. Also on July 3, 1835, children working in the silk mills in Paterson, New Jersey, strike for 11-hour workday and 6-day work week. With helps from adults, the kids win a compromise settlement of only a 69-hour work week. Also on July 3, 1917, 3 days of race riots end in East St. Louis, Illinois. As many as 200 African Americans were killed and hundreds wounded. This Week in Radical History for July 4, 1776. Some big country in North America unites and becomes the world's biggest colonial power ever to be known. Throwing off the shackles of King George, 230-some-odd years later, the people volunteer to put back on the shackles for another King George.
I'm the dictator.
Also on July 4, 1854, pre-Newt Gingrich, as Congress introduced legislation banning constitutional burnings, William Lloyd Garrison publicly burns a copy of the U.S. Constitution with the cry, So perish all compromises with tyranny. Also on July 4th, 1855, Walt Whitman, at age 36, America's first great poet, publishes his Leaves of Grass about his experience growing up in America and helping the wounded during the Civil War. I sing the body electric. Lastly, for July 4th, 1983, Reverend Jerry Falwell says that AIDS, which he calls the gay plague, is God's way of spanking us. Well, spank this.
For a while, you know, black people couldn't marry white people. Women couldn't marry men without being their property. We've seen the progress of civil rights in America reflected through the right to be married. And so we affirm that right here today.
With this ring. I thee wed.
I thee wed.
This is my favorite part. By virtue of the authority vested in me as Deputy Commissioner of Civil Marriage, I now pronounce you married under the laws of the state of California.
Two items for Radical History for July 5th, 1894. The Pullman Strike. Federal government and troops interfere with the peaceful labor strike led by Eugene Debs against the Pullman Palace Car Company, which was drastically reducing the wages. Federal troops kill 34 American Railway Union members in Chicago area attempting to break the strike. Debs and several others would be imprisoned for violating the injunction against striking by the federal government. Lastly, for July 5th, 1934, San Francisco Bloody Thursday, as police shoot down striking longshoremen and supporters, killing two and injuring over 100. The governor had called in the National Guard to suppress the strike, and rioting ensued. The known casualties include 34 clubbed, gassed, and stoned, and 30 were treated for bullet wounds. This week in Radical History for July 6th, I only have one item. In 1894, Nicaragua, U.S. troops invade Nicaragua on this date to protect American interests. Here's what news anchor Koppel had to say about U.S. intervention over the years.
No, Virginia, there is no Santa Claus, no Great Pumpkin, no Easter Bunny, and no Tooth Fairy. And as though that weren't bad enough, here's another shocker. The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
Now you can go where they get things done.
This has been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more information. Until next week, from the Glee Glee Studios, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. I close here with George Carlin.
I think the civil rights movement was an accommodation on the part of those who own the country. I think they see where their self-interest lies. They see a certain amount of freedom seems good, an illusion of liberty. Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Oh, I voted." Marginalized or made to seem either to be communist or was some sort of disloyal person, a kook, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that. Should not be even entertained for a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only way.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من خيام.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Before we get to our feature presentation from a forum at the Columbia University Law School, we want to take a minute to point out how once again, in the midst of devastating heat in Palestine, Israel is using the withholding of water as a weapon to inflict illegal collective punishment on the Palestinian population. Israel controls all the water in Israel-Palestine, even the water it extracts from the West Bank aquifer and the water under Gaza. It is liberal with water allocations to Israelis to fill their pools and bellies and water their shrubbery, but allocates little to Palestinians to meet the basic necessities for survival. And it charges four times as much money to Palestinians than it does to Israelis to purchase water, even for water it extracts from Palestinian territory. ADLA, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, sent a letter to senior Israeli government, military, and water officials this week demanding that they cease cutting water supplies to Palestinian residents of the occupied West Bank. But right now, it is worse than ever. There are areas of the West Bank that have received no water at all for weeks. Livestock are dying, fields and gardens are drying up, and factories and businesses are shutting down. We encourage you to Google the Boston Alliance for Water Justice to follow reports on this latest brutal assault on the Palestinian people and to join them in their organizing attempts to challenge Israel's assault on Palestine's basic right to survival. They are calling a demonstration in front of the Massachusetts State House on Beacon Hill on Thursday, July 14th at noon. Google Boston Alliance for Water Justice for details. And now on to our feature presentation. This past spring of 2016, Columbia University Law School held an interesting forum it called The Palestinian Exception to the First Amendment and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. This morning we will bring you presentations from that forum by Columbia University Law Professor Catherine Franke, Jewish Voice for Peace's Rebecca Vilcomersom, and Columbia student organizer for Students for Justice in Palestine, Shaza Abushi Dila, speaking at the forum. In her presentation, Professor Franke makes reference to legislation pending in the New York State Legislature concerning legislation that would punish those who chose to do business with any entity that supported the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Please note that that legislation has now been signed into law by New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo. And now, from the Forum on the Palestinian Exception to the First Amendment and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement at Columbia University Law School, we begin with Professor Catherine Franke.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is so exciting to see so many of you in this room. So I want to do just a little introduction about boycotts generally. The issues that we're specifically talking about today have to do with the Palestinian Exception to the First Amendment and BDS more generally. But my comments, just to set up my co-panelists, will have to do with boycotts more generally. Many of you, I'm sure, are aware and have liked and shared the fact that Bruce Springsteen canceled an event in North Carolina. Right? Governor of the state of New York, the governor in a number of other states, the mayor of the city of New York, and mayors in a number of other states have also pledged to boycott the state of North Carolina, and increasingly the state of Mississippi, because of laws that have been passed in North Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia. I just ran down from my office working on a letter analyzing the problems with a similar bill that's before the Missouri legislature. Boycotts are a familiar tool of pretty much every social movement. The Boston Tea Party was a boycott. We're all very familiar with the Montgomery bus boycott, where people of color boycotted the use of public transportation in Montgomery as a way to protest the racial segregation of people in public transportation in Alabama. When I was here as an undergraduate student at Barnard in the late 70s, we were boycotting grapes because the farm workers asked us to do so. We were boycotting oranges from Florida because, you remember her, Anita Bryant, was the spokesperson for the Florida Orange Growers Association, and she was a horrible homophobe whose work in the 70s led to, in many respects, what we're dealing with now in the South around religious liberty as a way to formulate a backlash against marriage equality, but not only that. Jews have deployed boycotts at a number of points in history, not only boycotting Nazi goods or German goods around World War II, but here on the Lower East Side of New York, Jewish women boycotted Jewish butchers because their prices were too high for kosher meat. I can keep going, and some of you have heard me go on quite a bit about boycotts through history. It's hard to think of a social movement that hasn't at some point deployed economic boycotts as a way to mobilize people through solidarity with forms of injustice across the globe. Of course, the economic boycott of South Africa is the one we're in so many respects familiar with. But the boycott today of the state of Israel is the same kind of tactic to mobilize an international community to protest not Israeli individual citizens, not Jews generally, but laws and policies of the state of Israel that violate international humanitarian law, that violate the civil and human rights of Palestinian people living in the state of Israel, and certainly the rights of people in the occupied territories. So like other boycotts, the boycott of Israel and of Israeli laws is designed to protest state policy and state laws that we feel are unjust and that we feel violate the civil and human rights of a range of people living in Israel and in areas controlled by Israel. Never mind the people in the Palestinian diaspora who expect and demand a right of return to their homeland. What I find particularly interesting about the way that the boycott movement has moved in connection with solidarity with Palestinian people is that it's been so incredibly effective that domestically the opponents of boycott in this context have turned to law to essentially criminalize this particular political tactic. So we have a bill in the legislature in Albany pending right now, that not many folks are talking about, that would render you unable to bid on and receive contracts for projects funded by the state of New York if you have endorsed an economic boycott of an ally. An ally is defined to include Israel, but not only Israel. It could include Italy, where I have friends who are boycotting Italy because they won't let same-sex couples marry. It could include France, that has policies that many regard as discriminating against Muslim citizens of France. It could include a number of different boycotts that are being mobilized these days to protest the official state policies and laws of our allies. But, of course, the motivation behind this bill in Albany is to target boycotts of Israel, economic boycotts of Israel. Not only would you be disqualified from bidding on public grants, the bill, if passed, would create and publish a state blacklist of people and institutions who have endorsed the economic boycott of an ally. Boycotts have a very bad odor to them, very bad odor historically in the United States, but generally worldwide. Blacklists remind us of the McCarthy era and the kind of lives, careers that were lost, that were stained permanently through a blacklist for those who were associated with the Communist Party. Blacklists were published in Ugandan newspapers, naming men who were suspected of being gay quite recently in an oddly named Rolling Stone magazine in Uganda. These kinds of blacklists are something, as politically active people, we should oppose. And it is certainly not an American value to have a state-sponsored blacklist of people who engage in constitutionally protected political activity, which is what boycotts are. And the Supreme Court has been very clear that economic boycotts amount to constitutionally protected economic or political activity. During the Montgomery bus boycott and other boycotts in the South, the businesses that were being boycotted brought a lawsuit against the NAACP, claiming that this was a form of basically unethical and illegal economic activity, coercive activity that the law should prohibit. Thankfully, the Supreme Court ruled against those businesses and said no in the Claiborne Hardware case, said no, this is protected constitutional speech and political activity. But the American Jewish Congress submitted an amicus brief in this case, in the Claiborne Hardware case, saying that political boycotts had a long and important history among Jewish activists, consonant with Jewish values, and that the AJC supported the NAACP and other organizations that were using economic boycotts to advance their political goals as a tactic of their politics. Who wrote the AJC's amicus brief in the Claiborne Hardware case? Alan Dershowitz's brother. Not funny, really. I mean, yes, funny, but not funny. What we're seeing in the move now to render boycotts unacceptable form of political activity is the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment. Whatever one might think about the merits or demerits of certain Israeli state policies and practices, surely we would defend the use of boycotts as a way to express our political values in this case, because if we don't in this case, we jeopardize the next case that you might agree with. So as a matter of principle, the kinds of laws that are pending in Albany and were passed in the state of Illinois and are pending in other state legislatures are problematic from a whole range of perspectives having to do with First Amendment rights to speech and to political action, where we're trying to express solidarity with people who are making human rights claims across the globe. So take a moment, check out what this bill is that's pending in Albany. I know some of you, many of you have been active in opposing the bill. It may just sneak through like things do in Albany with no hearing and no transparent vote. So if you have a problem with the bill, and I hope you do, regardless of your position on the boycott of Israel, you should care about this bill because of the things you do care about in your own political work. So what I'm going to do is pass the stage off to Rebecca Bill-Comerson from Jewish Voice for Peace, who Lizzie is about to introduce more thoroughly, who will talk a little bit about the ways in which the boycott of Israel has been misunderstood as anti-Semitic in nature. If there's anything you can draw from my remarks, it's that boycotts are a tactic of politics more generally. There's nothing inherently anti-Semitic about them. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Franke. Our next speaker is Rebecca Vilcomason. She's the Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace and has been a member of that organisation since 2001. JVP opposes anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim and anti-Arab bigotry and oppression, and I thought it was worth reading out to you their mission statement to give you an idea of what the work that they do if you're unfamiliar with the organisation. JVP's mission is to seek an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, security and self-determination for Israelis and Palestinians, a just solution for Palestinian refugees based on principles established in international law, and an end to violence against civilians and peace and justice for all peoples of the Middle East. Please welcome Rebecca.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for spending your lunchtime with us. I'm not going to say much more about Jewish Voice for Peace, given there's so much limited time and so much to say. But I did want to say, in terms of why I'm here, we do have a presence on the Barnard and Columbia campus. We have a very fierce and wonderful JVP chapter. Yay, lots of snaps, which works very closely, really in a beautiful partnership with SJP. So that's been really wonderful to see that evolving in the last couple of years. And then also we have an academic advisory council. So we have about 700 faculty who are members of our council. We're very honored and proud that Catherine is on the steering committee of that body, and I'm also very grateful to Catherine for giving the overview of boycott, because I really am going to jump into a sort of, not a 101 conversation about BDS, but a 201 conversation. And part of that is because I just feel like it's the one of the things that we're seeing right now are almost every day on campuses, new cases around the country of accusations of anti-Semitism being used to suppress conversation about boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, and I wanted to sort of lay out some of the observations that I've made in seeing a number of these across campus, but really setting out some questions and challenges. I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of a comprehensive answer to how we deal with these questions, but I wanted to sort of talk about what seems to be emerging in terms of not just one campus, another campus, but across the country. So it's important to note from the outset, and I think this is really important, is that the BDS movement is really gaining steam in the U.S. So we just had recent wins, G4S, Ahava, church divestment, campus divestment, even the anti-BDS legislation that Catherine talked about, I see in some ways as an indicator of how strong the BDS movement has grown and how much there's a backlash against it. So the increased reliance on accusations of anti-Semitism when talking about BDS, I think, need to be very much understood in that context. And then I also want to make sure that everyone's aware of the fact that there's very little honest grappling from BDS opponents, of course, not just with BDS as a set of tactics, but also with the conditions in Palestine that led to the call for BDS. So we're seeing more and more really gratuitous attacks and attempts to literally legislate against BDS. There's actually 22 states where there's legislation similar to what Catherine described in New York, and these attacks happening all over campuses. So this is clearly being used as a specific strategy. And I also want to point out that these attacks are not emerging spontaneously. They're really orchestrated by an array of very well-funded organizations that are specifically dedicated to fighting BDS on campus. So Sheldon Adelson, tens of millions of dollars, Campus Maccabees, the Israeli government, tens of millions of dollars, all kinds of organizations that are very specifically trying to stop the BDS movement and are using this particular argument to do so. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with what happened at the UC Regents a couple of weeks ago. To speak about it in like three sentences, although we could talk for hours about it. But basically, after a long battle, the UC Regents just passed some principles of tolerance that originally had language that said that, that basically equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and called it a form of discrimination. After a lot of pressure from students, a lot of fight back, that language was watered down to say anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism, which I don't know how that's different from anti-Semitism per se, but so there was, to some ways, the damage was mitigated. But there is a lot of concern about chilling effect. Who will decide what are anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism? So I think that, that's one thing, that battle that's happening on campus. It's also, we've seen on CUNY in the last few weeks. I'm sure a lot of you are aware of what's happening there. I'm going to go back to that in a minute. But then one thing I wanted to point out is that right after this UC Regents principles passed at Stanford just last week, there was immediately a pro-Israel group introduced a resolution using a quote from the UC principles saying that trying to attack BDS is anti-Semitic. And so it's literally trying to move this as a strategy from campus to campus, creating facts on the ground, if you'll excuse the phrase, to try to redefine what anti-Semitism is and redefine BDS as anti-Semitic. What happened with that resolution is that it was introduced, it was ultimately tabled, but also part of that story is that one of the students in the Senate that was considering this resolution, who was not affiliated with the SJP, who was not affiliated with any of the student activist groups, did make some what I would consider to be anti-Semitic remarks in the course of that. He talked about Jews controlling the media, controlling the government, controlling institutions of power. So what do we do when we have this conflation of both attempts to call BDS anti-Semitic, to call anti-Zionism anti-Semitic, but also occasionally actual anti-Semitic speech that comes out? How do we disentangle that, and how do we address that in a way that's ethical, in a way that's moral, in a way that's strategic, and still continue to move the BDS movement forward? I think that's what we actually really need to do. So, of course, I think and hope we all agree that we all must speak out against anti-Semitism when it actually occurs, but that we also, of course, need to talk about and reinforce the fact that the leadership of the BDS movement and all the SJPs that I've worked with, at least in my experience, have been extremely clear about speaking out against anti-Semitism. This is not something that's coming from those parts of the movement, and any attempt to conflate them is really wrong. And I do want to try to articulate, even though I think it's a little bit messy still, how do we talk about anti-Semitism in today's political atmosphere? So we have to condemn it when it's really happening, but we also have to be clear about how structural anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-black sentiment, anti-immigrant oppression, all those are still structural problems in the United States, while anti-Semitism does not have structural support in society. The forms of anti-Semitism we face are generally interpersonal and without that kind of structural support and are immediately condemned. And yet there's an inverse in the amount of attention being paid to anti-Semitism while there's this incredible amount of still racism, Islamophobia, and all these other kinds of oppressions that are happening. So how do we authentically condemn these kinds of anti-Semitic attacks while also putting them in balance with the reality of what students, faculty, and people in general in this country are facing? I think that is something that we all really need to be thinking about. And so, for example, the fact that the UC Regents was even doing a statement of principles that talked only about anti-Semitism and didn't mention any other forms of racism is an indicator of that. The fact that at CUNY, the Zionist Organization of America sent a letter saying that students were facing anti-Semitism on campus, and nobody even mentioned the fact that the NYPD had undercover policemen who were spying on Muslim students and reporting their activities, that is a structural problem. Anti-Semitic incidents are a problem, need to be condemned, but why aren't we talking about those structural issues and how are those structural issues being repressed? So we need to think about how to talk about that. The other thing is that I think it's very disturbing and we need to be talking more about the trend of actual anti-Semitic incidents being routinely blamed on Muslim and Arab students, or sometimes just on SJPs as a political body. And I think that is really giving actual anti-Semites, actual white supremacists, a total pass. So we see this, and I think Jewish institutions are extremely complicit in this. The moment there's an anti-Semitic incident that happens on any campus, you immediately see these attempts to connect it to BDS efforts on campus, to divestment efforts or whatever's happening on campus. And what does that say about how we're not addressing actual white supremacy, actual anti-Semitism that still exists? And it's really placing the blame on folks who are most vulnerable. So we need to figure out how to talk better about that. I do think that the conversation at the UC Regents was actually a step forward. I think it made discussion about anti-Zionism a legitimate political conversation in a way it hasn't been recently. There was a conversation in the New York Times about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism that I don't remember happening before. Peter Beinart's writing about it. All kinds of people about writing now about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and how they're different. And I think it opens a space to point out that there's actually a long history of Jewish anti-Zionism that's actually been flattened out in the past few decades. In fact, Zionism was always opposed by Bundists, by communists, by Orthodox Jews, just to give a few examples of parts of the Jewish community that have opposed Zionism. And so I think we need to continue to bring back those pieces of our history and make it clear that Zionism is not synonymous with Judaism, and that to criticize the actions of a state is not to criticize the Jewish people. To me, that seems like the clearest and cleanest distinction in how to distinguish between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. At the same time, we need to be on the alert to call out white supremacist anti-Zionism. So you have people like David Duke who call themselves pro-Palestinian, but that doesn't necessarily make you part of our movement, right? Our movement is about being committed to principles of freedom and equality and justice for all people. And so we do have these elements that are out there, and it's about defining who is part of our movement. And I also think, just a couple of final thoughts, I do think this conversation is an opportunity to recenter the experiences of Palestinians under Zionism in public discourse. And I think maybe I'll leave it there, because I do see this moment as a real opportunity. There's some danger in it, but there's an opportunity to really refine and articulate a vision of justice that applies to all people, to speak out clearly and ethically against all forms of racism and oppression, and also to really challenge the centering of Jewish experience when talking about Palestine. And I think there was a beautiful article that came out recently from Tufts, anonymous students at Tufts, who really challenged their fellow students to imagine what it felt like as a Palestinian to see their Jewish friends on campus getting free trips to Israel when they couldn't return to their homes even to visit. So how do we make sure that this conversation is really recentering those Palestinian voices?
Thank you, Rebecca. Our final speaker before we have time for discussion is Sheza Abushi Dalal. Sheza is a Lebanese-Palestinian undergraduate at Barnard College, majoring in history. She's a long-term organizer with Students for Justice in Palestine and one of the founders of Columbia University Apartheid Divest. Please make her feel welcome.
Thank you, Lizzie, for putting this together. So as Lizzie said, I am a long-term member of Students for Justice in Palestine and the founder of a recent campaign, or one of the founders, one of the many founders, of the recent campaign that we launched, Columbia University Apartheid Divest. And I'm really excited to be here today because we're always looking for opportunities to speak to larger crowds and people that we don't usually speak to, and the law school unfortunately belongs to one of the communities on this campus that we don't, as SJP, as Jewish Voice for Peace, as Apartheid Divest, usually get to interact with. So I think my general purpose, if Rebecca did a BDS 201, I'm going to backtrack and do a 101 for the room and really focus more on divestment, because that's what our recent campaign is. It's a divestment campaign. So, and also I would like to speak to you about kind of the historical trajectory of Palestine solidarity activism on campus, the type of backlash we face, the type of successes we have in general. So, Columbia University Apartheid Divest is a joint campaign launched by Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine and Columbia Barnard Jewish Voice for Peace. And we call upon the university to divest its stocks, funds, and endowment from companies that profit off of the State of Israel's apartheid system and military occupation of Palestinian territories. This campaign is embedded in the larger movement against boycott, that larger movement seeking boycott, divestment, and sanctions from the State of Israel until it complies with international law by ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands occupied in June 1967 and dismantling the wall. 2, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And 3, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. So for all the lawyers in the room, the law students, pretty basic. Compliance with international law, appeals to kind of very, very basic, very non-radical principles of what we should be standing behind as institutions, as individuals. And I want to speak to you a bit about divestment as a tactic and the history of different divestment movements on campus, successful ones, not so successful ones. This specific divestment movement, we've made the focus of our divestment campaign nine specific corporations because Columbia is a private institution and we don't have access to the full endowment, information about the full endowment and investments of Columbia. We have chosen nine corporations that we think give us an opportunity to illustrate the way in which a corporation can be
complicit
and can maintain a state of occupation and human rights violations in Palestine. And the idea is that by focusing on said corporations, we can demonstrate how a corporation can be directly involved in creating the technologies and the materials by which Israel maintains a state of policing, a state of continuous attacks upon a very vulnerable and constricted community, and an occupation. So the call for divestment comes most importantly from Palestine's civil society. Even if I, as an individual, am a Palestinian, or anyone else in SJP are Palestinians, we are, at the end of the day, a solidarity community. So we stand in solidarity with a call that is not our own. It is not the call of international communities abroad. It is the call of Palestine civil society. And it has proven in the past few years to be an incredibly powerful tool for exerting pressure, economic and political pressure, on a government that unfortunately continues to this day to get away with things that no other government does, with the very tangible financial and political support of this country. So we bring divestment to this campus, but this is actually not the first of very large influential divestment movements on this campus. On October 7th, 1985, the Board of Trustees voted to sell $41 million of its endowments and investments in American companies with South African connections, becoming the first Ivy League to join the movement to divest from South African apartheid. Then, too, our administration prioritized investment in profit-generating corporations over that which is morally sound. Then, too, it was argued that irrespective of the injustices committed under South African apartheid, total divestment would hinder economic prosperity for this institution. And then, too, it was the unity of activists across the spectrum of socially and politically minded organizers on this campus that courageously spoke truth to power and slowly but surely disrupted the mainstream hegemonic narrative on this campus. Most recently, on June 22, 2015, Columbia University Board of Trustees voted to sell its stocks in Corrective Corporation of America and G4S, making Columbia the first academic institution in the United States of America to divest from the private prison industry. This was not the brainchild of a President Bollinger who woke up one day and decided that he was no longer okay with having the university invest in a private prison industry. It was not. It was the fruit of labor of CU Prison Divest's victory, and it inspired a sense of purpose in the persistence of activists on campus who believe in divestment as a tactic and who believe that solidarity networks, persistent pressure placed on an institution's administration can actually result in this type of tangible political and economic pressure. And this is actually not even the first attempt on our campus to hold the administration accountable to its involvement in bolstering Israel's administration of military occupation. In 2002, faculty members across various departments called for an end to our investment in all firms that supplied Israel's military with arms and military hardware. This was a precursor of sorts to the type of divestment that BDS demands, but it was a very powerful one, and it was met with very strong statements from the administration and from the rest of campus, and unfortunately it failed. But I mention it because it's important to place this specific divestment campaign in a longer history of holding our government and our academic institutions accountable to the type of implicity. So unfortunately, it's, as I was stating, not our administration's natural instinct to stand on the right side of history. It's a lot of work. We don't have to go that far back to notice trends in campus populist unaccountability. We can consider our administration's systematic oppression of its workers today. We can consider our campus's expansive exploits into West Harlem, making our administration directly implicated in socioeconomically harmful trend that is gentrification. And we can consider our administration's very recent $10 million investment in the private prison industry. So when I was preparing some of these notes for you all today, I was thinking I'm going to speak at the law school. I have to appeal to law students. And really, the point that I want to drive home is that this movement is one that demands political accountability to international law violations that directly impacts the subject of your academic study and your professional careers to come. And the type of backlash we face is also a massive violation of First Amendment rights, in free speech in this country. So a Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal Joint Report titled The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, from which we get the name of this event, came out this fall documenting over 300 incidents of repression. Columbia University has the highest count of those incidents, the highest counts documented. And I, if I may, would like to give a few examples. Do I have time? So in March 2014, we experienced the removal of a banner. And it's a very famous incident that we speak about at almost every single event, but I think it's very important because it embodies so many of the types of struggles that we face as Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, and generally Palestine Solidarity activists. We hung an administration-approved banner on the building at the entrance of Barnard College. And overnight, due to the influx of complaints that, as Rebecca noted, are never spontaneous, it was removed. This is not an isolated incident. We are always pushed out of spaces in which our voice is a powerful one. And it is not spontaneous. We have, since the launch of our divestment campaign, I'm going to cut the examples because I want to have time for a conversation, but since the launch of our divestment campaign, we have had two petitions released. One has 200 plus signatures of faculty members opposing BDS, and that type of mobilization is very serious. The second is in response to a statement made by our allies, the International Socialist Organization, that included the word intifada. 600 plus signatures were collected demanding that SJP, that made no such statements about the intifada, condemn the use of the word intifada, which refers to 600 plus made up of community members, which refers to a Palestinian resistance movement, the first and the second intifada. And we're asked to condemn this because it is terrorism. And this is a type of policing of vocabulary and of actions and involvement that is far too frequent. We also had this new McCarthyite website called Canary Mission. It's not very new, actually. It's 2 years old. But the week after we released our divestment campaign, this website and their motto is ensuring that today's radicals are not tomorrow's employees or something like that. We had 40 profiles from Columbia published within a week. My personal profile is something like 9 pages long. I have an infamous quote section, 8 videos, and something like 45 photos of myself posted. And, you know, even my parents are mentioned in the thing. And this is, you know, if you Google my first name, this comes up on the first page. So this is not just an effort to delegitimize a movement. It's also to delegitimize the individuals so that before the administration comes and shuts down whatever actions, whatever banner you've put up, you self-censor yourself. And we don't have a large community of people standing with us, people standing in solidarity, people organizing directly with us. So where do you move forward from here? How do you grow? You grow. We need to embrace the principles of intersectionality that so many different social justice movements have at their core in today's organizing. It is very difficult for student groups to stand with us because they end up being faced with the same type of repression that we do. When different student clubs were issuing statements of support with us, they all came to us saying, we have never in our experience of organizing received this many complaints, this many death threats, emails threatening our physical safety on this campus, and that really is indicative of something, but it's important. And now for the first time on our campus, we have something called the Barnard Columbia Solidarity Network that really taps into those types of intersectional social justice organizing. It's made up of No Red Tape, the Anti-Sexual Assault Organization, the International Socialist Organization, Columbia Divest for Climate Justice, Barnard Divest, also for climate justice, Mobilize African Diaspora, Student Worker Solidarity, Jewish Voice for Peace, and JVP. We organize together, and that type of network is really invaluable, because our movement needs to be a diverse one. And to the law students in this room and the graduate students in this room, I say that the higher up in academic ranks that you get, the more it is not just a cause worthy of your attention, but a cause that you are responsible for. Because you are more likely to not only be a student, but an employee of the university. You are more likely to be paying rent. You are more likely to be directly contributing to the scholarship and publications of this university. And that means that what we are invested in is your responsibility. So I urge you to organize with us, join us, and
you have been listening to a Columbia University Law School forum on the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or within a two-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. If you miss a program on the WZBC archive, remember it is only on this archive for 2 weeks. You can find any of our past broadcasts on our permanent archive, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive, to hear any past broadcast, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All of our past broadcasts are on truthandjusticeradio.org Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be a conversation with anthropologist, professor, and Israeli activist Jeff Halper. We will discuss Jeff's new book, which explores Israel's burgeoning weapons development and security technology industry that has become the center of the Israeli economy. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Bradley Stokes, UKIP Chair Ben Walker, as well as Mike and Magda Bond, former producers and presenters of the BCFM Polish Show. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, at 87 years of age, the great Alvin Toffler is dead. His 1970s book, Future Shock, prophesied a world where technology and events would move so fast that teachers, the public and even journalists wouldn't be able to keep up. Would be so stuck in their ways and incapable of analysing or contextualising current affairs, the way could be left open for the rise, again, of totalitarianism. Also, Manfred Petrisch is a former Swiss investment banker turned rogue. He is now running a blog called All Smoke and Mirrors, where he dishes the dirt on Henry Kissinger, the Bilderbergers and the global elite. He explained to me earlier this week how he realised we're being ruled by a criminal elite, why we've lost the battle for democracy, and how the next world war to cover up the financial crimes is likely to start, and what we can do. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows tonight of 11 Celsius, mostly dry and breezy. This weekend, highs of 21, sunnier on Saturday, sunshine and showers, though, on Sunday. So don't think about shopping tomorrow, go out instead. Next week, highs of 21 again, a fairly cloudy week with some showers and sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of July, highs of 21, fairly sunny with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Bradley Stoke, UKIP Chair Ben Walker. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Could you, do you think, explain how you were voted in originally as a Conservative, but then decided to turn to UKIP?
Oh, wow. OK. I've forgotten that, to be honest.
I know, it's a while ago. The thing is, I think, for most people, if they're voting for you as a Conservative, they would expect you to carry on your term as a Conservative, wouldn't they?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I basically jumped ship before it became fashionable to do so, basically. And it was, I just couldn't come to terms with what the Tories stood for anymore and the backbiting and backstabbing, to be honest.
Well, just give us some examples. What specifically did you think you were standing for as a Conservative? Councillor that you later found you weren't?
Oh, huge amount of things. I mean, one of the biggest things that I actually, I knocked people's doors for and stood on was to, not affect the NHS, you know, all that sort of thing. And then as soon as the Tories get in, you get the biggest reorganisation that you can see from space. So that didn't go down too well with me.
Okay, and also, what about your relationship with Jack Lopresti, who's the local Conservative MP up filled
yeah,
with Bradley Stoke?
Obviously, I was mayor of the town at the time, and he was the, parliamentary candidate, and we helped to obviously get him elected, and then as soon as we kind of did that, I found that he was working behind the scenes to try and undermine my candidacy for a different area.
Interesting. I mean, Jack is an interesting character, isn't he? Really best known as the kind of Bedminster corrugated iron ice cream man. You see Jack Lepresti's ice cream van up on the Downs quite often. And he also was on this program, well, possibly 3 or 4 years ago now, promising me that he would get me the Freemason Book of Bristol, because he is a Freemason, and he promised me he'd get me that book. I'm afraid he never did get me that book. He also promised that I was going to get a tour of Freemason's Hall. I never got a tour of Freemason's Hall. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to call him a liar, but he did promise both of those things, but and I didn't get actually either of them.
Yeah, he's certainly building an interesting profile for himself. I don't really what more I can say about the guy, to be honest.
Okay, and also, what's your thoughts, Ben, about particularly this week, the running for various characters running to be Conservative leader? I mean, we announced this time last week David Cameron was standing down as leader and that the race has started. What do you think about the candidates?
Yeah, well, I think what David Cameron did, it was probably one of the most statesmanlike and dignified things that he has done in his term as Prime Minister, or terms as Prime Minister. I thought, you know, I enjoyed his speech. I thought it was a good speech. He did the right thing. With the candidates coming forward, well, I mean, yeah, that it's difficult, isn't it, to try and pick a good one, to be honest. I can't see any of them that have the attributes to try and, you know, move this country forward, unite the country, and actually, more importantly for them, unite their own party.
I mean, one thing that seems to be quite important from a UKIP point of view, and you are UKIP chair at Bradley Stoke, is that that somebody who was actually part of the Leave campaign should take over the Conservative Party. But that seems to be falling by the wayside, with Theresa May being many of the grandees of the Conservative Party, including, of course, Bilderberger and Remainer Ken Clark, saying that Theresa May is the person and that Michael Gove should stand down.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that, you know, people have been very critical of the Leave campaign for not having a plan afterwards. But I think by the same token, the government didn't have a plan either, apart from how they were going to stop Boris. And I think that's what you're seeing in play now. I'm pretty sure that Michael Gove has been promised some nice little cushy cabinet post for doing what he's done. And I'm sure this has all been planned some time ago.
Well, we're finding UKIP and various other characters, including the Tory Leave campaign, is backtracking almost straight away, aren't we, on things like the pledge for £350 million a week to be going into the National Health Service.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think...
Why backtracking? That's not fair, is it?
No, it's not fair. And the one thing that I would say about the campaign is I was pretty disappointed from both sides of the campaign. I think it was light on facts, it was heavy on fear, and I didn't enjoy either side, you know, either side's argument, and I certainly didn't enjoy the campaign.
But
for me...
you were part of it.
I mean, I was part of it.
So you should influence it in the right
direction.
Well,
I mean, having said that, yeah, we could only do what we could locally. So basically, the campaign itself was very fractured from the beginning, and that was almost by design. So we never knew who we were working for, but locally, as a branch, we did most of our stuff for the Go campaign and then Leave EU. And the most important thing for us, over and above money, over and above immigration, was actually sovereignty. And that was the thing that we championed locally.
Okay, well, I'm also joined by Magda and Mike Bond. Both of you, welcome to the show. Your thoughts initially on the vote last week?
Do you want the truth or something beautiful, as a singer once said? We're still pretty angry with it. I mean, the Leave campaign itself... Every little Leave campaign, because it was, as you said, it was quite fractured. Every little Leave campaign promised something different, and now the Remain campaign, this is remaining. That's the thing, and so it was kind of oddly stacked. So all of these different campaigns were able to promise every little thing that wanted, and so you've got your 350 million. That pretty iffy figure, even that, on the side of a bus driving all the way around. You've got other campaigns promising, you know, immigration controls, you know, NHS. You've got all of these kind of, this kind of fractured thing. And, you know, no wonder on Friday morning everyone's going, well, I didn't promise that. But somebody promised it. And even if you're not part of an official campaign, there were lots of kind of, I say, funded the UKIP kind of campaign funded by Aaron Banks, who funded a lot of those Leave campaigns. You can put the They were able to say whatever they want. That was frustrating from an electorate. This is going to come as a surprise to Magda. Our neighbor didn't vote because she was so incredibly confused about everything that was going on. And there were so many of the messages that were coming out. You know, Leave could just go, no, that's a Project Fear. And that was repeated so many times.
Magda, I wonder what you make of all of this, because obviously yourself as someone who's Polish, it's almost like we don't want you here. That's the kind of message that I think a lot of Eastern Europeans have got from this.
Not only Eastern Europeans, but any Europeans, really. Well, I'm gutted, I'm shocked, I'm surprised, I'm angry, I'm in despair. But I'm not losing hope because of Bristol, because well done, Bristol, 62% of you voters to remain, and this is something uplifting and positive I'm taking out of it. Because this is obviously it showed that this is the right city for me to be in. But yeah, going back to the whole campaign, the campaign started many years ago. I remember working on the Polish show on BCFM and already getting messages of incidents of people being racist. And I was thinking like, okay, maybe my natives are exaggerating a bit. Turns out they didn't, because after the result, what happened, it's like the with some people who voted to leave, the inner xenophobic or racist came out, and now it's almost in fashion to say those horrible things, which British people weren't like that before Friday. Not everyone, at least there was some sort of control.
So what about Ben's point though about sovereignty? I mean, you know, as a Polish person, are you happy for the Poles to give up their sovereignty to Brussels?
I mean, it's a big sort of word and concept you're waving with. To be honest, there's always a parliamentary election in European Parliament. There's your vote. Go and vote. Make a difference. Instead of like, boo-hoo-hoo, oh, I can't, you know, Brussels so bad, can't do anything, let's just leave it.
The MEPs can't really change anything. They don't actually make the laws. The laws made by the Commission, which is mostly these failed politicians.
Yeah, but in the UK Parliament, the MPs don't make the laws either.
They do. That's absolutely incorrect, because the British or the UK Parliament, they can actually debate and they can change legislation. The European Parliament, it just comes through and they rubber stamp it. The commissioners put that forward and it's rubber stamped through the Parliament.
Where do the commissioners come from?
Well, they come from the member states, but they're not elected.
Well, we don't elect many of those who behind the scenes in the UK. House of Lords is a very trite example.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree with you on that.
And those members of the commission are appointed from elected governments.
Can I just make a point, Michael, to Ben? I want you to answer this, because we're about to get a new leader of the Conservative Party who nobody has actually elected.
Yeah.
With that being the case,
if you're saying this is a democratic system, it doesn't sound very democratic.
No, it doesn't. And I would hope, I would very much hope that given the results of the EU referendum, they actually then go back out to the British public to get a mandate to push forward.
What about Magda's point there? Well, it's just like saying, let's have another referendum on the EU.
But the outcome of the EU referendum is so huge and affects every aspect of the country, its services, its sectors, whatever. No party, especially the Conservatives, even though they believe they have a mandate 15 months ago, they don't have a mandate to move forward now.
But if we have every 5 years we have a general election, why not have a referendum every 5 years? I mean, this is what happened, for example, with the Lisbon Treaty. They kept having another go, didn't they?
Well, I mean, democracy takes time and it costs money. And I'm not against having a referenda for big issues.
I bet that if the Remain campaign would have won, UKIP would be the first one and Nigel Farage to saying, yeah, let's go for a second referendum because I don't agree with this one. So,
I don't think that's true either. And I'm not the biggest advocate of Nigel Farage, but what I would say is sometime before that he said that he wouldn't be calling for a second referendum.
That's not actually true. He was saying if it was close, within a wider margin that it was, let's have a second referendum. If it was 48-52. That's what he was calling for.
Let's bring Martin in here. Martin, what do you make about this? Sort of, we can have a general election every 5 years, but only one ever referendum.
Well, referendums do take place from time to time in Britain. I mean, we had the one over the Irish peace agreement, for example, which was a simultaneous referendum north and south of the border to ratify the agreement. And it was a necessary thing to tie everybody in, you know, because the Republicans had believed up to that point that they had a mandate dating back to the Sinn Féin Jane Doyle of 1918, where they'd been in the majority, and the hardliners in the IRA had always said, well, that's our mandate. And of course, by the Republicans agreeing to an all-island referendum on the peace agreement, that took away that particular prop of Republican history. So, you know, referendums can be uniting as well as dividing. It just depends how they play out. I mean, it's just part of the political game, isn't it?
Well, it's not surely a game. I mean, this is actually how you're supposed to run a country. It was invented by the Greeks, I think.
Well, listen, the British political system is absolutely sclerotic. We need PR. We got PR in Northern Ireland as a result of the fact that people went...
This is proportional representation.
Proportional representation.
Actually, most European countries have
that. Well, most European countries do have it. And, of course, what would have happened if we had proportional representation at the last election, it was for the very first time in British history, you would have had a right-wing majority. Because UKIP and Tory votes together would have been enough to form a government. But that certainly wasn't true during the Thatcher era, where in actual fact the left, if you count the Greens, this SDLP, the SNP, etc., Plaid Cymru, and Liberals, we've always had a majority, which we never were able to do anything about. Thatcher was able to do all the things she did on a minority of the vote, and the current Conservative government has got all power, and they're now electing a new leader on the basis of something like 30% of the vote, if that.
Now, you've just used the word sclerotic, which is... Yes, I have to agree with you. Sometimes looking at the system, it's just not working. But we're sitting in a country where last year we had a general election where now between 15 and 20 of the constituencies, it looks like the Conservative Party overspent and did fraudulent accounts when they were reporting in those constituencies.
Well, in particular, they targeted that at the UKIP constituencies. So I think that's something that's going to run and run, hopefully. I think, you know, looking at the positive side of this is... You know, if we'd had a Tory UKIP government under PR, then we would definitely have had a referendum.
Yeah.
And it would, and the result was likely to be as it is. I'm a bit surprised by the Welsh, frankly. I mean, I was reading in the newspapers about a Welsh town.
You're disappointed.
No, I'm just saying there's a Welsh town whose name I've forgotten, where they've got the highest EU subsidy in Britain anywhere because of they get Objective One status and so on, and they voted to leave the EU. And it's like, well, if you want to do that, that's fine, but who do you think is going to fund your community centres after that? Do you think Michael Gove is going to dig into his pocket for you?
I think, the answer to that is because people were voting against the immigration. People are, in the last few years, upset about the numbers of migrants coming in, whether from Europe or from outside of Europe, and they were just scared. So that was the fear factor, and basically vote to leave, so you vote against the immigration. And then you've got on Friday already people saying to other people, oh, come on, leave our country, get on the bus. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not leaving anywhere. It's my country as well.
Just to say, I mean, I completely agree, and I understand that immigration has been used as quite a hot ticket throughout this whole debate, and I don't think it should have been. But actually, it's a little bit unfair to say, especially if we're talking about the Welsh, that it was just about immigration. Actually, I think it's people feeling disenfranchised from the political system as it is. They just feel it doesn't represent them, they can't engage with it, and it's kind of a vote against them. It's kind of an up yours to the system kind of thing.
So basically the referendum is often has been voted on. They're not voting for the thing that is on the ballot paper. They're voting for some other problem.
Well, no, they are. I get what you're saying, but they are voting for that as well, because an up yours to the system is an up yours to the EU. They're part of the system. We've already got a system which is difficult enough to engage with for your average person, and then broad brushed along the top of that, you've got the EU. And it's very hard for people to just try and get their head around how politics works, to be honest.
Martin has said something there about proportional representation. I wonder what Mike and Magda, what you make of that, because in our general elections, it is this first-past-the-post system actually discards tens of millions of votes, doesn't it?
Yeah, the problem you've got with proportional representation in this country is you've got to change the political attitudes, first of all, because there's no incentive that no one works together. Everyone's fighting. You see it in Parliament and Prime Minister's question times. I mean, they're just having a whale of a time, just shouting and screaming.
Well, even within the parties.
Yes, exactly. And with proportional representation, you've got to have an attitude of working together. And frankly, sometimes it just doesn't happen even in those other countries. But because they've had that history of proportional representation, they're kind of forced to work with it. And they sometimes get along and sometimes don't. But with the current attitude of the MPs, you know, you just couldn't work with it. We had the first hint of something that was a coalition, And you saw what happened with that.
Can I just say, Tony?
I used to work in Poland, and I went to the same in Poland. And if you see, in Poland, the same is a circular building. And they sit in a circle, and then when you enter into
it
the...
It sounds a bit kumbaya.
It was built after the changes as a means of, you know, expressing the new political order in Poland. And so the gangway to come in separates the far right from the far left, so they can't scrap with each other. And, of course, if you go into the chamber, you can speak for 10 minutes, and you get 10 minutes to speak, and they just get up, and they trundle through their speech. Nobody's listening. They then press the button, and they go away. And in actual fact, it's like watching paint dry.
Ugh.
But in actual fact, what's actually happening is people are all in their offices around the building, keeping half an eye on what's going on in the chamber, where you're just getting stuff on the record, doing deals with each other behind the scenes, because that's how PR works. And PR does force you to say to people, as in Ireland, I have to say, if you're not going to vote for me as your first preference, do consider me as a second preference, which means that you don't have to actually slang each other off to the same extent, because you're actually trying to persuade people who are not completely on board with you to come on board with you. So you then change your style. You have to.
Well, I imagine this whole idea of proportional representation is something that, if it does come along, is going to break the consensus, so-called consensus, it's like a kind of cartel consensus that Ben was talking about earlier. But unelected by anybody apart from his own constituents, one of the people who looks like they may be in the line to become the new Prime Minister is Michael Gove. So let's have a listen to what he had to say earlier to the BBC.
I thought it was right that, following the decision that the British people took last week, that we should have someone leading the Conservative Party and leading the country who believed in their heart and soul that Britain was better off outside the European Union. And I hoped that Boris Johnson would be someone who could ensure that the government followed the instructions of the British people and also build and unite a team around him in order to lead this country forward. And Boris is an amazing and an impressive person, but I've realised in the last few days that Boris isn't capable of building that team and providing that unity. And so I came reluctantly but firmly to the conclusion that, as someone who had argued from the beginning that we should leave the European Union, and as someone who wanted to ensure that a bold, positive vision for our future was implemented, that I had to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party. I would want to be captain of a strong team. The first thing to do is to recognise that we need to draw on all the talents that the Conservative Party has. Indeed, we need to draw on all the talents in the country. I want to lead a government in which people with wise heads and generous hearts work together in order to ensure that the decision that the British people made on the European Union is honoured. That means that, first and foremost, we need to take this country out of the European Union and into the world. We need to restore parliamentary control of our borders, taxes and laws. But above all, we need to build a much more dynamic economy and a fairer society. When people voted to leave the European Union last week, they were voting for change. And there are far too many people in our country who felt that recent economic growth and renewed prosperity hasn't touched their lives. There are far too many people in this country who felt left behind and overlooked as the world moves forward at a faster pace. I want to govern for everyone in this country. I want to heal and unite. And above all, I want to ensure that Britain is a country that others look to with admiration, because we're the home of innovation and creativity, but we're also a warm and compassionate place that everyone is proud to call home.
That's the candidate for the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister, Michael Gove, there, speaking to the BBC earlier. What do you make, I think we'll start with you, Ben Walker, UKIP chair in Bradley Stoke. What do you make of Gove's prospects? Because really, it's a bit of a bombshell, old Boris pulling out. I mean, what do you make of all of that?
I really don't know what to make of it, to be honest. I said earlier, I think it's been a done deal for a while. I think they knew they were going to do this. But I don't honestly believe that Gove wants the job. I don't think he wants it at all. Well, that's my feeling.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he has been, he's been on TV on numerous occasions saying he didn't want the job.
Yeah, but they all say that, don't they?
Yeah, but him in particular. And
I think you've got to watch anyone that says, I really do not wish to become Prime Minister.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being forced to do this.
It is a strange one, and I know that he was one of the leading lights for Vote Leave. But he has got a tainted past himself, hasn't he, with his issues over schools and stuff when he was the Minister for Education. You've got this email from his wife at the moment, which is kind of pulling the trigger.
You know, so he's, you know, I don't know whether it's
true or not. Some people have said he's got rid of thousands of prison officers.
Yeah.
He's got rid of 17,000 police officers. Oh, that's Theresa May that's done that.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not him. And privatised something like 20,000 schools. So, you know, is this the guy that is really going to lead the country?
No, I don't believe he is. I mean, I want to see a Brit exit leader, you know, a new leader. That's what I would like to see. And the trouble is, we're picking from a really bad bunch. I think the only person that I would really put any weight behind is Andrea Leadsom, who I think will be a well-balanced leader and a woman, which is, again, a good thing, I think, at this time.
OK, Mike and Magda, what do you make of the various candidates? Is it really feasible to have someone who is a fence-sitter during the campaign to take over the Tory party now?
Well, what if you look at the referendum results, it was close. I mean, in terms of the percentages. And so you need someone who is neutral. You can't really have someone who is definitely leave because the Remains will hate them. You can't have someone who is, you know, in vice versa, okay? So, I mean, the current, I think, favourite is Theresa May, okay? Now, that is someone who is just today has basically said she wants to use EU citizens in the UK as hostages in the negotiation process. And so, from our perspective, that's no better than any of the others.
I think most journalists in a country want to shoot Theresa May anyway because of what she's doing with the Snoopers Charter, which is spying on journalists, spying on MPs, spying on MPs, on lawyers. And so when you're going to chat to your lawyer about some court case that's coming up, she wants the GCHQ and the National Security Agency to be able to spy on you. So that's another side of Theresa May, which is a little bit chilling. Anyway, Magda, what do you
mean? Yeah, she's a really nosy woman, huh? I'm typically British, isn't it? And well, when I listened to that speech by Michael Gove, I think as much as I sort of dislike him, he picked up on something that's important and might explain the whole result, is people want change. It doesn't matter what change, they want something happening. And the same thing happened in Poland when in October 2015 people went to vote for a new government, and despite the years of really decent life and, you know, we had freedom, we didn't have any communism anymore, suddenly people voted in a very right-wing party. And the funniest thing out of all of that is that it's the people in their 20s voted for almost a nationalistic party, whereas it's the other way around in Britain, in a way. So I think there's a wave of upset.
Well, no, it's the same, surely. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
People are voting effectively for UKIP when they're in the referendum, but not when it was a general election. What do you put this down to? Because it's sending a message to Brussels. Look, you're not getting it right. You sort yourself out, otherwise everybody's going to leave, and maybe Brexit is going to only be the first one.
And I think they should be rightly afraid of it. And to be honest, I think we need people, sort of normal citizens, getting more involved with Brussels and its structures.
But they don't seem to be, do they? This is, I mean, we had earlier in the year, right at the beginning of the year, David Cameron going, basically begging on his knees to Merkel and Hollande, saying, please, we need some real change in our relationship with the EU. And they just basically stuck two fingers up on him, didn't they? Told him where to go.
Well, me and Michael can go and sort them out, huh?
Anyway, Martin, what do you make of Michael Gove and his candidacy and what he had to say there?
Well, the political meat to this is that what Bojo was suggesting was that he would go for the option. You were talking about fence sitters. He was talking about, we'll stay in the single European market, and therefore we'll probably have to accept what Angela Merkel's made absolutely plain. If you want to be in the single European market, you've got to accept free movement of labour, because that's what everybody else has got to accept. And I think that would have been a halfway house, but I think, you see, Murdoch and Paul Dacre at the Daily Mail and the people who and the UKIP by and large do not want to accept free movement of labour. I think even, you know, that you don't solve the immigration problem by saying people can't come. The US says loads of people can't come from Mexico and Guatemala, but they do come because their economies have been destroyed by 30 years of Reaganite policies in that region. And the same thing also happened in Eastern Europe. What happened in Poland before they joined the European Union was that the Thatcherite policies pursued by Balcerowicz put most of the country on the dole. And then, of course, they were told that, you know, what you do, you've got to get on your bike and come to Britain or wherever it is. I think most people don't realise what was at stake. And now Gove has made it quite clear he wants to leave the single European market. Now, that means, ultimately, that we're going to have a hard border in Ireland and possibly a hard border in Scotland, although that's receding now after Sturgeon got knocked back by Rajoy from Spain and so on. But all of these big questions are still rolling around. And, of course, we've still not talked about the real problem, which is the banking system. Deutsche Bank were nearly crashed this time last year when the Greeks threatened to leave the euro. And the Greeks, who are much more politically educated than the British, realised what they were doing. They were threatening to leave the euro, repudiate their private sector debts, which had been transferred to the European Central Bank, and that would have crashed the European banking system, pulling down the American banking system after it. The people running Syriza, with a majority of the Greek population, didn't have the courage for that, which is why Varoufakis resigned from the government and came over here to campaign for Remain. But the fact is that the British, what happened was that Steinmeier and the Germans forced the Greeks to knuckle under and recognise that they couldn't just crash the banking system. Everybody's too scared of crashing it. And then Boris Johnson turns up and presses the button anyway. Bang! What's going to happen over the next few weeks is, as Italy's bonds spread goes up.
I'll remind listeners that Martin has been saying this since 2008.
The effect on the pigs has been, you know, that Poland, Italy, Greece, Spain has been disastrous. Yeah, and what will happen is they will ultimately be forced out of the euro, which will crash Deutsche Bank, which will crash the world economy. So don't forget that the Japanese stock market went down the drain because Britain voted for Brexit. Most people in Britain, I don't suppose, in Sunderland or in South Wales, had much thought about what would happen to the Japanese stock market when they voted. But that's the world we're in. And we haven't been talking about the banks for 5 and 10 years.
Well, George,
we should
Osborne,
have been talking. George we should Osborne have been talking today, about them, but we haven't been talking
Martin,
about them.
George Osborne today was talking about the banks, and he said as a result of Brexit, it looks like he won't be able to balance the books by 2020 now.
Well, that's not just about the banks. Of course, Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds are not going to be privatised anytime soon because their share values have gone down
by
30%.
What do you make of his announcement today?
Well, what it means is, when he said we're going to balance the budget and that we're going to pass a law to make us balance the budget, I said, well, that's like passing a law saying we want sunny weather. You can't pass a law like that. Inevitably, if there is a crash, the deficit will increase, and rightly so, because if it didn't increase, the crash just intensifies. The purpose of having a welfare state is not just to help the poor, it also cushions the economy from shocks. And those countries which have a good welfare state, the northern European countries like Sweden and Finland and so on, they survive shocks better than those that don't have one. I mean, in Greece, there is no proper unemployment benefit. You've got 60% unemployment for under 25s. They are living on their parents' and grandparents' pensions, because there's no unemployment benefits. And that makes the economy incredibly vulnerable. Now, we've actually sawed away at our benefits over the last 30 years, and when the crash comes, the people at the bottom will feel the pinch.
I guess if we had been part of the euro, Magda, we might be in the same situation as the Greeks with this mass unemployment.
Yes, I think so. I mean, to be honest, in Poland, there was never like a welfare system anyway in the first place. So if you didn't have a job, tough luck, basically. And maybe that also explains why Polish people are more prepared just to leave their own country and go and try to get a job elsewhere. Because if you were unemployed, the government wasn't looking after you as it does in Britain. It has changed now because the new government offered something like a child benefit. Thanks to that, they also won elections. But it's interesting yet a bit scary times to be living in right now, I think. So,
what do you make of this one of the main calls, which has been that people, for example, there's a whole massive load of migration to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, mostly from the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. from Pakistan, from Asia, from the West Indies. I mean, I've spoken to some people and heard other people talking about this, saying, well, look, a lot of the original migrants to Britain in the 50s and 60s have said, well, it's taken us decades to establish ourselves and to get a decent living here in Britain, and now we've got people from Eastern Europe coming, taking our jobs.
Well, to be honest, the job I applied for, there was no queue. I think I was the only person. Nobody wanted that job many years ago. Actually, I'm not going to apologize for it. There was a job offer. I applied. I went for the interview for the whole procedure. I got it because there was no other person interested in it. And yeah, I think a lot of Polish people do not come here for benefits. A lot of Polish people come here because they know they will get fairness. In Poland, quite often when you want to get a job, it's about connections, knowing people, having a sort of your back covered. Whereas Britain offers a fairly fair process of this is the application form, this is the interview, I need the references, there you go, there's a job. So I wouldn't say Polish people are coming here for benefits. And to be honest, if I think about Polish people I know, none of them got any benefits because, in a way, it would be embarrassing. I mean, I would be personally embarrassed to phone my parents and say, oh, yeah, mom, so after studying, now I'm on benefits. My goodness, they would just rip me apart on the phone. So, yeah.
So what's your own situation? Are you, I mean, because actually you're married to Michael, so probably you're okay to stay, are you?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a British passport. Which costs £1,000 for a EU member to get, and £3,000 for a non-EU member to get. I think I will be now trying to apply for a British passport. But yet again, I'm thinking, like, why do people assume that if you've got British passport, you're suddenly like a better person? It just doesn't make a difference. I've been living here for 10 years, paying taxes, not going to NHS because I do believe in paracetamol, Lemzip, go. Lemzip. And I've been a good citizen. So there's a lot of Polish people and other Latvian and Spanish and so on living like that. You might get a small percentage that are sort of misrepresenting us in the right-wing press, but most of us just stick to the rules. We play by the rules.
Could you maybe tell us about some of your other Polish friends and how it's affected them?
Well, I can tell you that, for instance, people with Polish first name or Polish surnames who were even born here are suddenly being challenged when having a conversation, or people whose accents you can hear that there's not a Bristolian accent or there's not a British accent in their speech, they're being challenged, and not jokes, because it's not a joke anymore now, just to get your suitcase packed and off you go. The school I work in, which is an inner city secondary school, I had some of our kids, Polish kids, they're asking me, oh, miss, what's going to happen? And I have to say, well, actually, you know what? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen because, and they were saying like, oh, we've been here like 2 years or 3 years, so that's not enough for residency. So what will happen to us? And those are kids who already speak English, who are studying towards GCSEs, and who are part of the society and the sort of the British landscape
here. Ben, this isn't very British. It's not very fair, is it, to invite people over to come and work here and then tell them thank you very much, off you go.
No, I quite agree. Again, it's one of the whole argument about, EU migrants coming across and taking all our benefits. I think that's an outrageous argument, and I cannot believe that it's even been used, because for all the, if we're talking about Eastern Europeans, they have got to be, obviously, and listening to you as well, some of the hardest working people that I've ever come across in my life. And I get quite frustrated with this, because I don't believe they're coming over to take jobs. Well, yeah, okay, they're coming over here where they're taking jobs, but like you quite rightly said, no one else is going for it. And there's a bigger problem here as well. We have, I'll use the term, indigenous British people, if you like. What are they doing? Why have we still got 1.7 million people that are unemployed? You know, that there's a bigger question to ask there. So you can't then just turn around and blame EU migrants that they're taking all our jobs and taking our benefits. I think it's just nuts.
Martin, this has got something surely to do with the fact that the economy's not actually doing very well and the jobs just simply aren't there for everybody.
Well, let's just make...
And the actual amount of money people are getting per week is not enough.
Well, the real wages haven't risen in a long time, that's true, for various reasons. But let's just make another point. The demographic of the people who've come here are the ones that are paying into the system rather than taking out. So there's no doubt whatsoever that the younger, more mobile, educated people from Poland and elsewhere who've come here are contributing more than they are taking out. When they get old, it might change around, but at the minute, that's the situation. And of course, in many ways, that's not such a good thing for the countries they come from. It's what used to happen in Ireland and Poland before the war, which is that and still happens to some extent in peripheral countries, where local people pay taxes to educate their young young people, and then those people go with all of their skills, and they never participate in their own country. And I was actually involved in discussions about what should happen in the Polish economy after the changes in 1990, and that was before Poland was in the EU. And in actual fact, I was working with Marek Kuchelski from Warsaw University, and we went to see John Fleming, the head of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, to talk about a Polish strategy, which would have been not a full-on free market strategy, because you're trying to reform what is a communist economy. You've got to start with what you've got, not just say this is all rubbish and start again. You've got to look at what you've got and think how you can make it work. Anyway, I knew what would happen when we went to the meeting. John Fleming just laughed in our faces and said, well, you're never going to be allowed to do that.
Fleming, of course, being the banking family that Ian Fleming was a member of.
Well, I don't know whether John Fleming...
James Bond author.
I don't know whether
he was.
John Fleming was the family. Anyway, the point he was making is that we wouldn't be allowed to do that. And what Marek used to argue is we want to join the European Union in the long run. But it was the British in particular who pushed the idea that the European Union should be expanded rapidly in order to... basically for geopolitical reasons, to get them out of the Russian orbit and all the rest of it. So a lot of decisions were made at that time, which were political decisions which had no real economic rationale. And that's why, along with the euro not being flexible enough and so on, we've ended up with the mess we're in. But leaving all of that aside, the fundamental problem in 2008 was in Lehman Brothers in New York. And that is still the center of the world financial system. But of course, what will happen as these dominoes go down is that we're all going to be thrown into a massive global crisis of a kind that we haven't seen for a long, long time. And of course, that is what we should have been discussing at the last election in Britain. But instead, we're talking about Brexit, which in actual fact, in my view, is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic either way.
Okay. Well, we'll be having a listen in a minute to... we'll be just discussing some of the strange goings-on over the weekend and the Labour Party coup. With John McDonnell speaking today to sort of try and consolidate, I suppose, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. But first, let's have a look at a couple of stories that are just sort of in the local and national news. But first of all, child poverty is rising, because we can often forget these with the Brexit and the bigger matters. Child poverty rises by 200,000 on the previous year, official figures show. Child poverty has risen by 200,000 children over the past year. The numbers released today as the government faced paralysis in the wake of the EU referendum show 29% of children are now classed as being in poverty. The households below average income statistics published by the Department for Work and Pensions reveal 3.9 million children are now in families struggling to make ends meet. Of those families, two-thirds, that's 66%, have at least one adult in work, with poverty now no longer being the preserve of the jobless. So the message here, I guess I'll start with you, Ben Walker, is the idea that you can get a job, but it isn't actually going to be provide enough money for you to live on.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I read a short story about this figure at the beginning of the week, and I was shell-shocked. I mean, you kind of know it's going on, but when you read it, it's an official report. It's not good reading. And I think, you know, Martin's touched on it again. It's just, you know, wages haven't increased for, I don't even know how long. Do you, Martin? I mean,
well, real wages in the United States haven't risen since 1973.
I mean, that's outrageous, isn't it?
Well, that's why you've got a crisis.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the old days, as productivity increased with technology, you then, wages are raised automatically through trade union power and so on. But that means the people have got the money to buy the stuff they've produced. And, of course, it's very good profitable for the financial system that they don't. But ultimately, they then have to be lent money to buy the stuff that they used to buy with their own money. And that can't be...
People just don't have disposable incomes under these sorts of circumstances. Anyway, Mike and Magda, what do you make of this? 200,000 more children in poverty.
Well, I can say that in the school where I work, in Bristol, we do provide free breakfast for all students. I think we've managed to get some funding from the government within the last 2 years. And it is a very popular meal. And there's a lot of kids coming for 8 o'clock queuing to get some toast or some bacon bread roll and some baked beans. So it is used, and I think it's needed. It does make a difference for a child to start their school day with a full stomach. We do also have quite a few of children on free school meals. So that sort of shows you what sort of area we're maybe targeting or we're serving.
What about sorting this out? Because we can't continue down this line. We're going to end up with, three quarters of the children in the country living in poverty. How are we going to deal with this? Any thoughts from either of you? Michael?
I think very simply, we've just got to get better jobs out there. I mean, I think that is ultimate solution. I mean, if increasing benefits is really just sticking plaster over a problem, increasing benefits is great if you're caught between a rock and a hard place, fantastic. But I think ultimately we need to be focusing at looking at the bomb. We need to be thinking about training. You know, university education needs to be made affordable. And if you've got people who are properly trained up, they can do proper jobs.
But Martin, I mean, most of the employers and public sector will say, well, we just simply don't have the money to pay people enough.
Well, that's not true. I think the austerity agenda is gradually unravelling here because it just, you can't do it. Go on.
No, and it's just about the you're talking about kind of jobs. The company I work with, we offer paid internships. It's enough a little bit of a wage to do it. We can't fill it. We can't get the people with just the skills below the level we need. And we will train them up. We will get them too. But they need to be of a certain skill level, and we just can't get them. We eventually fill them by kind of looking at other pieces, but we just don't get the applicants for it who can even do that kind of basic. And this is why I think training is so important. It's not an easy fix. It's not something for now. It's something for the future. And if you look at something like the German system, which has technical schools which are respected, if you go on a technical stream or an academic stream, you're viewed in a fairly kind of in a good light. Not in the UK, where if you go to a technical school, well, it's just a dumping ground for anyone and everything.
Okay, another story. Sorry to interrupt you there, but we've got to move on. Parents have been let down by Bristol Children's Hospital's cardiac ward. Children receiving cardiac treatment at Bristol Children's Hospital repeatedly given poor care, and parents were let down, a review has found. Independent report revealed nurses were regularly under pressure, and there was poor communication with families. Well, there's a vast amount of poor communication coming out of United Hospital Bristol's NHS Trust, chaired by John Savage, who's a Labour Party local big wig in the Labour Party, also a former master of the Merchant Venturers, spending something like £500 million of our money every year on our hospitals. But bad communication is one thing when you're spending more on building contracts to make the outside of the hospital look nice, but you're not making sure that there are nurses by children's beds who've just had heart operations. This is not good, Ben, is it?
No, it's not. It's a terrible story. I mean, I don't know too much about the details of the building for Bristol Hospital, but if it's anything like Southmead, you've got a building that's owned by Carillion, and in the end they're going to have to pay for the building four times over.
It's just a private finance.
Yeah, and to change a light bulb, it costs about £250. And you've got these trusts shouting from the rooftops how great their hospitals are, but yet they can't even supply basic care for the most needy, which I just think is terrible. The massive problem with this is it's just going to carry on and on and on. You know, the parents shouted and screamed. They wanted a review. They got a review, but the review just consists of regurgitated information.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think the fundamental point is the things like the private finance initiative and the creation of the internal market in the National Health Service back in the day. I make the case on this show every week. There is a case for central planning. Hmm. Not everything should be decided by a market interaction. Markets are expensive. You've got far more people pushing paper now than before because they've got this supposed internal market. But of course, the danger is it's going to be opened up to being an external market. And if we sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which you haven't mentioned, all of these things will then be open to challenge if you don't open it up, and so on and so forth. And of course, interestingly enough, I would like to ask Michael Gove, who was on this show, does he intend to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as many right-wing Tories do? Lilly doesn't, actually, which is very interesting. Mm. Because in that case, what's the point of leaving the EU if you're going to sign up to the trade deal that the EU's done with the Americans anyway, and so we're just going to be in the same boat with everything run by Washington and Brussels? I mean, surely we should just knock the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership into touch at this point. And Manuel Valls, who's the finance minister in France, Gates, who's facing off these big strikes at the minute, he said that TTIP's dead. So maybe
one of the things
that
really bothers me about this story is that we're in a situation where the merchant venturers, the former slave traders, are now sitting in very key positions in many of our public services. For example, what you would call it a public service, Bristol Water. We had the guy on here who was Chris Curling, last year's master of the merchant venturers, helping to run Bristol Water, making a vast amount of money of what used to be public utilities.
Well, indeed. Well, the merchant venturers are our local version of that parasitic class. They are a parasitic class, let's be clear. In Ireland, there was massive demonstrations a couple of years ago when people had to pay for water at all, because in Ireland, water was free, literally free. But in Britain, I live in a bedsit and I have to pay £40 a month for a shower. Ridiculous.
Absolutely insane. Anyway, we're going to talk about the Labour coup in a moment. But first of all, I was listening out for it all over the airwaves. Even went and switched on BBC Parliament, BBC News. Nowhere was it to be seen. The Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell's talk today, he gave a press conference about the Labour coup attempt, which was started by Hilary Benn last weekend.
We've had the resignations, and I found it really disappointing. Just at a time when our country needs us and people need to step up to the plate, now's not the time to stand down. I just say that. To behave responsibly, do your job. Wouldn't it all be better if the people just came back and worked with us? So the appeal from me is to everyone calm down, think of the interests of the party, yes, but the country more importantly, and come back and start working with us again. People out there can understand what's going on when our country needs us so much. And also, let's be a bit party political, when the Tories are in such disarray as well. This is the golden opportunity for us that we should choose. It's on the basis of a relatively recent invention by the Greeks. It's called democracy. Jeremy's the leader of the Labour Party. He's staying leader of the Labour Party. And if there is a challenge, there'll be a democratic election. Jeremy will stand. He's automatically on the ballot paper under our rules. He'll stand. I think he'll win. The media, sorry if I get, this isn't me paranoid, but the stories that went round a few weeks ago that I was building a plot to oust Jeremy and replace him. This week, the story is I'm forcing him to stay. Now, we've got to get this right somewhere along the line. So let me just make it absolutely clear. I will never stand for leader of the Labour Party. If Jeremy is challenged and there's a leadership campaign, I will chair his campaign committee. Full stop.
That's the Shadow Chancellor, Labour's John McDonnell there. Martin, would you like to explain what's been going on for us? Because I don't know if even the coup plotters really understand what they're trying to do.
Well, I mean, don't ask me what the coup plotters are trying to do. It's becoming clear. I mean, in the last week, 60,000 new members of the Labour Party have appeared. And one of them is somebody I work with. And I can tell you now, he didn't join the Labour Party in the last week to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't suppose any of that 60,000 did. There is a precedent for this situation. The Labour Party in New Zealand split in the 1980s. Now, I don't want to split. I think what McDonnell was trying to do there is try to mend fences with those who've gone through with this coup attempt. But the fact, and all three Labour MPs in Bristol have gone along with this attempt, which is an actual fact to my mind is going to cause a lot of ructions. But what he's trying to do now is, because there hasn't been a leadership challenge yet, Angela Eagle, who was suggesting that she might, has held back. And it may be that there won't be one, because in actual fact, the way I see it, under existing Labour Party rules, there is no way a challenger to Jeremy Corbyn is going to win.
I notice
at all. No chance.
One of the new team,
whatsoever,
after all these mass resignations, one of the new team is Paul Flynn, Labour MP for Newport, who's now, I think, for the oldest member of the shadow government since Gladstone.
Well,
he's 87 years old, he's now in that position. I mean, it's rather interesting.
That's because all of these people have ruled themselves out by resigning.
Also,
but Paul Flynn's very good, actually. He's one of the best constituency MPs, very solid socialist. I'm very happy for him to be in
also
the shadow cabinet.
Worth pointing out that Angela Eagle resigned, citing Hilary Benn's dismissal as her reason, but she set up a website called Angela for Leader 2 days before before that. And this has led a lot of people to look at the what's really been going on here. And a very good article by Nafiz Ahmed, Blairite PR firm tied to Labour coup, knew of mass resignation pact 6 months ago. Effectively, what they're saying here is that this Portland Communications PR firm has actually been orchestrating this coup from behind the scenes, along with people from the Fabian Society. Now, certainly would suggest, and I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, people have a little bit of a look at this. But Martin, I mean, maybe the truth of the matter is that there's been a resentment that's against Jeremy Corbyn by people who are kind of friendly with Hillary Benn since the Syria bombing vote last year.
Well, it goes back further than that. Angela Eagle voted to go to war with Iraq. And in actual fact, we've kind of got over that. We were mad as hell about that, mad as hell. And, of course, the Chilcot report is coming out very shortly, and it will be a whitewash, but it will remind people of what a terrible decision that was. The decision to go to war in Iraq is probably the worst decision by a British Prime Minister since Suez, since Munich. And it's led to an absolute disaster and catastrophe in the Middle East. Every day in Baghdad, people are dying. And in Syria and elsewhere, and that's our responsibility. It's the Labour Party's responsibility. The most of the a substantial chunk of the Labour Party didn't go along with it, and we told people who did go along with it, it may take us years to get you, but we will get you, and we will get them. They've come out of the closet here. And Hillary Benn's speech. Can I just make a comment about that? What I'm going to say to Angela Eagle or anybody else who stands is, do you know what Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, said about this? He said, I was approached by the British before the Arab Spring, said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? So we have prima facie evidence that the British started the war in Syria.
That's not so much prima facie evidence.
No, well, we're going to rail about
it. PSA. But anyway, Michael and then Ben.
Yeah, I just want to add, it's not entirely a coup that people want Corbyn to go. I am a Labour supporter. And I found Corbyn to be a weak leader, especially over this referendum thing. He was so lukewarm, he was almost invisible throughout the entire process. So it's not just, there's a, you know, everyone's
for Corbyn. Ben, we're just coming up to the hour, so Ben, what's your thoughts?
I mean, it's very interesting for me to watch in. I've got no real view on leadership of the Labour Party either way, but for me it just shows you that actually the Labour Party is really split into three divisions.
Martin, there. Finally, is there going to be a challenge or not?
I think they will, and they're going to lose.
Okay, thanks very much to our guests, and that was as chair of Bradley Stoke UKIP. That's Ben Walker, also Mike and Magda Bond, former producers.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we spend the hour dealing with critical media literacy in higher education with student researchers at San Francisco State University and Project Censored affiliate professor Ken Burrows. They'll highlight their work on the news that didn't make the news while offering alternative perspectives on reimagining our world. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we again turn to critical media literacy in higher education, and we are in conversation for the hour with Ken Burrows. He's at San Francisco State University, a longtime affiliate of Project Censored, and on the board with us at the Media Freedom Foundation. And we'll also be joined by several San Francisco State University students that are contributors and research contributors to the upcoming Project Censored book, Censored 2017, in celebration of the 40th anniversary of Project Censored. So we are going to be joined again by several students in this first segment. In addition to Ken Burrows, we'll be joined by Michael Todd. We'll also be joined by Brandy Maselli. And then later in the program, we'll be joined by Daisy Iroka and Jillian Solomon. But let's start off with you, Ken Burrows. Let's talk about this process. You have an incredible gathering of students and researchers at San Francisco State University and have long contributed stories to the Censored Cycle and Censored Book, the validated independent news stories, so to speak, which are posted at projectcensored.org, so listeners can actually follow along and look at the stories that the students researched while we're on air. But Ken Burrows, talk to us a little bit about this process for you, the significance of it, and what you get out of this.
Good to be here again, Mickey. We've been doing this for, I believe it's 7, possibly 8 years as a Project Censored team on our campus. And every year it becomes a little more clear about what we're doing and I hope more effective. Every year varies, but I find it really a fascinating thing. I hope that somehow we can expand to even more campuses. Aside from the critical thinking exercise, which is just great for students to explore alternative media and find stories that vitalize classroom discussion and really help us engage and possibilities about a future that's unfolding. And if it is news that isn't really being discussed in a corporate sense, but really we're not hearing about it, it's often a surprise to half the students in the class, and there's the discussions that come out of that are extremely rich.
I want to also add, Ken Burrows, you teach holistic health studies. Mm-hmm. You have developed a fantastic holistic health center and library at San Francisco State University that's more than just an educational facility. It's really a hub where people come and talk mm-hmm. about important issues. And so that's a really important component of this, sort mm-hmm. of the human element, the face-to-face element that you experience with your students and help mm-hmm. build interpersonal communication skills.
Very much. We have a library, but the library is only a part of what we call a community action center. It's the information that underlies healthy choices. How do we come to those healthy choices, and how do we engage in that? And some of this is certainly what is newsworthy for these healthy choices in our lives today and over the year that we study the stories. So this is what our community is about, is engaging in these conversations. And out of that, certainly the research that they do deepens the conversations they have with each other. And then in our weekly meetings as a Project Censored culture, there's just, again, a vitality that shows up with the ideas that each student is finding and bringing to the table.
Ken Burrows at San Francisco State, you were very active 13 years ago with a big conference that Project Censored put on there, and we began exchanging information and nominating stories back then. And of course, San Francisco was really probably officially the first campus to be the second Project Censored site, along with Mickey Huff at Dabble Valley College, was pretty close in there as well. But then we're now up to some 25 sites all over the country, and hundreds of stories and student researchers being involved. So it's really grown and expanded, and I thank you for helping us kick that off. It was a great thing.
Yeah, it was a great conference. We had some 1,200 people, if I remember right.
That was 2001, the Alternative Media Expo, spring of 2001. Yes.
It was closer to 2000, actually,
wow.
The registered.
I remember it was huge.
That was a big conference.
It was a huge thing. Yeah. It was great, and a really great sense of feeling at it. It certainly kicked up a lot of energy in our campus that's continued. So,
well, let's turn, Ken Burrows, to one of the students that you worked with at San Francisco State University. Michael Todd is with us in studio. And, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing at SFSU, how you got involved with the Project Censored Research in particular. And then we're going to jump into one of the stories you researched that's called Audi Creates a Synthetic Diesel Fuel from Air and Water. But go ahead, tell us about yourself, Michael.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the chance to be here. I'm from the Northwest. I grew up in Oregon, and I lived in Seattle for a long time, too. I moved down to San Francisco about 3 years ago, and I'm an environmental studies major here at SF State. And my emphasis is on the urban environment, because I feel like one of the things I want to do in later life is I want to work on the way that cities and everybody uses their resources, because it's one of the biggest problems we have as a society is our resource use is just unbalanced. You know, we bring all this stuff to the city, and then we just kind of waste it for the most part, and we don't really use it right. And that's kind of why I got so excited about this story and decided to do it for Project Censored, was because it takes away one of the big sources of pollution in our society, which is carbon pollution, carbon dioxide released from cars, because cars are something that we all use, and they produce a lot of pollution, a lot of carbon dioxide. And it puts pressure on already existing carbon systems. We just have a carbon cycle. You know, trees, they grow, and then they die, and then they release CO2 into the atmosphere. Then that CO2 gets taken back by other plants that put it into themselves. And then when they die again, they release it back into the atmosphere. It's a cycle that's been going on for millions of years. And what we're doing is we're putting pressure on it by releasing a lot more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than plants can take out of the atmosphere. And it's causing a lot of problems with climate change. 350 parts per million is the level that we really can't go over as far as having strong changes to our climate, but we're already over 400 parts per million. And so that's one of the bigger problems that we're going to need to deal with.
It's certainly a significant challenge, right? Mm-hmm. And again, as Ken Burrows was saying, you were saying, Ken, that students maybe are unaware of some of these stories. We extrapolate from that, the larger public mm-hmm. is really unaware mm-hmm. of some of the significance of these kinds of stories. And Michael Todd, one of the stories that you researched, that you worked on, had to do with Audi creating a synthetic diesel fuel mm-hmm. from air and water. This was originally published by Gizmag. I believe it's Eric Mack. It was a story that was from actually 2015. But can you tell us a little bit about the story you researched and why was it important to you and why should people know about it?
One thing I think that's really compelling about it is its solution-based approach. You know, we've got a lot of people saying, oh, this one's wrong, these are all these problems, but there's not a lot of real good solutions to them. And I feel like this is one of them. And so what they did was German scientists, working out of Dresden, a company named Sunfire, they partnered with Audi and they figured out how to make diesel fuel out of carbon dioxide and water. And they basically reverse engineered the same process. Like when we burn stuff, we basically set the stuff on fire and it takes the carbon and then these long hydrocarbon chains, like, and they cut those apart and then that releases energy. And that's what we use to do work. And so what they did was they basically reverse engineered the process. They took CO2 and H2O, separated the carbons and the hydrogens from the oxygen, and then put the carbon with the hydrogen and made hydrocarbon chains. And then once they did that, they just refined it like oil and they made synthetic diesel out of it. And it's clean burning. There's no sulfur in any other toxic chemicals like are normally found in fossil fuels. And the best part about it is it's carbon neutral, which means that for every atom of carbon that you burn, it was an atom of carbon that was taken out of the air. And so it doesn't unbalance the cycle. And what they do, it's a really simple process. They use renewable energy, windmills and solar power to power their heaters, and what they do is they heat steam to about 800 degrees and then they pressurize it. When that causes the hydrogen to break from the oxygen, and then they mix it with carbon dioxide, and again they pressurize it, and that causes the carbons and the hydrogens to come together. And they have it what they call as blue crude. And so then once they have the blue crude, they just refine it like you would normally refine fossil fuels.
And what you're saying, though, this is entirely from air and water.
Entirely from air and water. They take the carbon dioxide straight from the air.
So at this point, it's essentially experimental. They've done it in laboratories or on a small scale. Is this adaptive to global transportation needs?
It seems like it's going to be a little bit more expensive per liter than what you would normally pay for diesel fuel in Europe right now. before tax, but they plan to make it scalable, and it is usable. They talked about one of the heads of Audi putting it in their car and actually using it.
Ken Burrows, let's bring you back in. You're the faculty evaluator and advisor on this, and mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about your process, of kind of how you follow the lead of students like Michael Todd and their passions and interests.
It's a great job, actually. I really enjoy it. I think one thing that's unusual with the way we orient to the stories for Project Censored is that many of our stories are constructive, such as Michael's. Almost half of our stories that we submitted this year, we submitted 22 stories, and almost half of those were constructive, solution-based, or I even prefer a term that's broader than solution, which is generative, which I think Brandy will speak to in a moment. That solution-based speaks about specific problems that we can solve, but generative-based solutions are about really focusing on a whole different way of orienting our imaginations and our society toward thinking differently about what's causing the problems as well. So it's very preventive. So I love that so many of our stories are really very positive in tone. And yet I also find that they're often not picked as the primary stories. I noticed that we have a number of our stories appearing in the future book. They're all from the other half of our stories, which tend to be, I think, most of us, it's part of our, just part of the architecture of our nervous system, that we react to threat. In biology, it's called the negativity bias. And this negativity bias is in all of us, that we have to be paying attention to the threats in the world. And those particular threats grab our attention at time. And what is left is that our imagination is often not sparked by possibilities. And generative journalism, which we'll hear about shortly, is about asking questions in such a way that we start thinking in preventive ways, not just problem-solving ways. So we're focusing, we hope, on a next cultural chapter that might really help Project Censored in a new way.
Well, that's very good, and collaboration is certainly what we're about at Project Censored. The voting selection process is quite detailed, as you know, going through some 28 judges and other participants. And so we do, however, house the stories at the ProjectCensored.org website year-round, and the website gets far more traffic than the annual book. And the way we see it, and Andy Roth and I see it, is we celebrate every story, every student, every campus, every affiliate. We think all the stories are significant and important, regardless of where the rankings or hierarchies in the book goes, because, as you know, Ken Burrows, it's the process and the work that goes into it and mm-hmm. and what comes out of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very positive process, and we're really happy to have you and your students.
We just finished up what probably was our final meeting this year, and I noticed the tone of the meeting and the sense of engagement and accomplishment that students had was very different than last semester and very different than this group early in the semester. So I'd love to see it build on itself, and it's very, very empowering for students.
This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we're going to be joined by another student at San Francisco State University, Brandy Maselli, and we'll continue to talk about the stories that are under consideration for the next Project Censored book. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at critical media literacy. We're looking at some of the Project Censored affiliates program. We're joined by Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University, who was kind enough to bring many of his students with him today to share with us the research they're doing on important underreported news stories, and also many of the stories that are put forward by students at San Francisco State University look at a positive or solutions type aspect. And before the break, we heard Ken Burrows talking about what our next topic will be, which is actually generative journalism. And we're joined now by San Francisco State University senior Brandy Maselli. So Brandy, tell us a little bit about yourself. how you got involved with the project here, and then talk to us about a couple of the stories that you've been researching, which are on the projectcensored.org website and are quite fascinating. Brandy.
Thank you. I'm definitely happy to be here, and thank you for having me. And thanks for the reason that we're here, and that's Project Censored. I've had the pleasure of working with and getting to know some awesome peers of mine. We gather every week, sometimes twice a week, to talk media literacy, and that's something that we should all be talking more about. This semester, I wrote a few stories, and one is called Generative Journalism, Catalyzing Creative Possibilities Versus Reporting Facts. And it's about the fact that most news that we hear is about what we fear: natural disasters, failures, fraud, murder, war. And this fear-based perspective is quite overwhelming, and it leaves out the vast amount of human behavior that is cooperative, caring, and mutually supportive. Axiom News coined the term generative journalism, and it speaks to that crisis that we have existing in journalism today, and it promotes society's common good. It uses narrative skills that help give birth to what's most alive and important in a community, and it often begins with a question, a proactive question, and I'll give an example that Axiom News used in Peterborough, Ontario. What if we could actually feel like co-creators, restored to creative power in the neighborhoods and communities that we live in? This reporter's question inspired members of Peterborough to create Citizenship Unleashed, a group helping people change the way they feel about their community and to get them acting on what matters.
That's fantastic. So did you know much about this generative journalism concept prior to encountering this story? Was it something that you, because I know that you're involved in journalism at SF State.
And, I certainly am. Yes. Yeah, I've been studying print and online journalism for the past 4 years now, and I'm also minoring in holistic health. I found out about Project Censored through Ken Burroughs in one of our holistic health classes, and it was really a time in my life where two of my passions collided, and that's why I'm here, and that's exactly why Project Censored has captured me so much, because in studying journalism, I've realized and I've been overwhelmed by this crisis of fear-based news and reporting on things that simply they muffle what's actually happening and going on in the world. And that type of journalism certainly serves its purpose, and we need to know, you know, things that are going on, but there's a part that is not being told, and that's the part that has ensued my passion more than anything.
That's heartening to hear, and as we also say quite often at Project Censored, really the next generation, it's the young people in our society that I believe strongly are the real drivers of change and are going to be able to provide some serious focal points for us, not just to tinker or reform the existing systems and institutions, but create and reimagine new ways of doing things. And in this case, for journalism, maybe citizen journalism, is new ways to communicate with society at large, not just about the challenges we face, but about reimagining the way that we exist and that we do things.
I certainly agree with that. It seems like this generation that we have of journalists up and coming kind of really get that. And we're talking about stories that really matter and are not so much based on, you know, the negativity going on in the world. We're seeking out things that people are doing that are creating shifts within communities, and it's very enlightening and great to be a part of.
Well, Brandy Maselli, you also have a couple of other stories that you were researching, and they do lean more toward the other type of journalistic angle that we've been talking about, and Ken Burroughs had mentioned, pointing out some serious gaffes, problems, more than gaffes, they're not mistakes. A lot of these kind of things are designed to work in a way that protects the establishment, the plutocracy, from true grassroots democracy movements. One of those, of course, is Google could rig the 2016 election, and voter fraud is given this big cachet in the corporate news media. But the real problem is actually election fraud, right? Not individuals posing as others, but systemic problems. And this story with Google is a pretty serious one. And there's another that actually dovetails on a theme we've done here at Project Censored for a long time, and that's the problems of COINTELPRO, government surveillance, and the use of technology to sort of stymie First Amendment rights. And there's another story. The FBI has a new plan to spy on high school students across the country, particularly targeting Muslims, particularly targeting people in this stereotype from the so-called war on terror. Brandy Maselli, do you want to talk a little bit about either of those stories and your research in them?
Sure. So each story, I think, is equally important. I'll touch briefly on both. Google could have possibly been rigging elections ever since it has begun, since their search algorithms control your news feeds. Google decides which web pages to include in search results, and so basically anything that you search, it's going to keep promoting. It's tailored to you and what you tend to search, and so moving into the top slots can mean a difference between a vote between Hillary or Bernie, or even Hillary and Donald Trump. The second story that I wrote is how FBI wrote some new guidelines that instruct high school students to report fellow students who criticize government policies and Western corruption as potential future terrorists. The guidelines are so vague and so broad that it's hard to know exactly who they are talking about, but it's almost seemingly relevant that they're targeting Muslim students.
That's some serious dragnetting that is likely to have a chilling effect on freedom of speech among young people. I find that particularly disturbing because it's targeting younger people. In this case, let's be frank, we're talking about minors. We're talking about kids.
Indeed, the FBI guidelines blatantly say that high schools and other, you know, younger education are hotbeds for anarchist extremists. It's ridiculous. I think that even if we have Muslim students in America traveling to what the FBI would consider a suspicious country or practicing their religion in an open space, that is no reason that we should even be targeting them.
That might include critical thinking students inside of the Project Censored process, because the term anarchism is grossly misused, and, you know, it implies bomb-throwing chaos and that sort of thing. But it's really democratic decision-making at the lowest possible level and critical thinking at the same time.
That's right.
And that's certainly what we do. So to have the FBI encouraging people inside of high schools to be looking for critical thinkers and people who might be questioning power.
Right, large corporations, government organizations, you know.
So my students were amazed when they saw that. They saw that in my class this semester, and we talked about it in Sociology of Power. They were impressed that you'd done this work.
And it's very important that you're doing this kind of story, and the independent journalists that write these stories, it's very important for students to be aware of all these alternative sources and have places to go and create their own sources of information, right, so that they can share those with their peers and so on. And certainly this kind of story really gets kind of the heart of Project Censored's mission to tell the news that doesn't make the news and sort of analyze why. And this is part of a long-standing tradition in American history, in particular, of stifling First Amendment rights, pejoratively labeling people with differing ideologies that challenge capitalism and establishment order and the plutocracy. It definitely reminds me of another person that was seen as an enemy of the state, Emma Goldman, who once said the most unpardonable sin in society is independence of thought. I'm a proud sinner in that regard, of this, perhaps the rest of us in the room here. That's a very important thing, and I'm very heartened. I'm just heartened to see so many younger people doing this kind of research, doing this really important work, because this is lifelong work. Again, it's really heartening to see Ken Burroughs, your efforts, and the students you have at San Francisco State University really rising to the occasion and really charting the path of what they think is most significant and important. And I think that really bodes well. We hear so many negative things in the corporate media about the millennial generation and so many negative stereotypes that are so off mark. And we have to remember the millennials are now the largest. They're larger than the baby boomers. So we ought to really be careful what assumptions we're making and what we are trying to ascribe or prescribe to these this entire generation of people. And perhaps we should start listening. Ken Burroughs?
Well, I think we are. At least I know we are in our classes. And yet often young people come in feeling there isn't much they can do about anything. So setting up some possibilities that they actually can step into something that's authentic and real. I mean, when they get real news and real information, all of a sudden they start thinking in ways that are truly critical and appropriate. And it's, we use the word empowering, but it's also very engaging amongst themselves. I think in our classrooms and in our meetings together, certainly at Project Censored, there's a lot of o's and ahs when people bring their news research. Really? That's really happening? Let me see that source. And there's a lot of back and forth about challenging, and appropriately so. So to be critical means to be, not accepting, but in fact, having good thought and good social engagement go on. So to me, it's very much about building community. It's very lonely to try to solve these things on your own. In fact, it's not going to work. So to be in discussion collectively around these powerful ideas is very appropriate and engaging.
Brandy Maselli, last words from you here in this segment. What do you hope to do? This knowledge you're accumulating, these skill sets you're accumulating, I can see a trajectory for you, but let's hear from you.
Sure. Project Censored has more than inspired me to go out into the world of journalism and do really great things. Here at San Francisco State and Project Censored, we're expanding and we're working on creating a magazine of our stories that we submitted to Project Censored this year, which I'm really excited about. And in terms of career outlook, definitely hoping to promote some generative journalism in the world and hopefully create some shifts with writing.
Brandy Maselli, thanks so much for joining us. Michael Todd from San Francisco State, thank you for joining us in this segment. We're talking about critical media literacy education. We're talking with Ken Burrows, Project Censored affiliate professor at San Francisco State University. And we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to hear from a couple more students about more of the stories that they're researching for this Censored 2017 cycle and the 40th anniversary for Project Censored that's coming up this fall, where students and Ken Burrows will be giving workshops and talking about this very important work. This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we're looking at critical media literacy education, and we're focusing on Project Censored affiliate professor Ken Burrows and his students at San Francisco State University, the stories they're researching and that they're contributing for the next Censored book cycle that Andy Lee Roth and I are working on. It's in celebration of the 40th anniversary of Project Censored. And we are joined by two additional students for this segment. We're going to hear from Daisy Iroka and Jillian Solomon about the work that they've been doing. And, of course, Ken Burrows is still with us in studio, and he will be chiming in about what's happening at SF State and what he hopes to have happen here with these stories. In fact, we're talking about contributing to the Global Critical Media Literacy Project site to have segments on all of these kinds of things, particularly the generative journalism material that Brandy Maselli brought up in the last segment. So we'll certainly be getting into that in this half hour. But let's go ahead and jump right in with you, Daisy Iroka. You were a student at San Francisco State University, now in graduate school, but tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in this project, and some of the stories that you're still researching.
I'm a holistic health minor at SF State, so that's how I got involved. I've been Ken's TA for like a year. I've known Ken for a while. So how I knew about Project Censored, I signed up to take his class for 2 units as a TA, and he said for the extra unit I had to do something else. So he mentioned Project Censored, and I was like, okay, I'm not a writer. I don't know if I could do it, but I just jumped into it anyway. And then I've just stuck with it, and I've loved it, and I was just like, okay, these are stories that I've never heard before, especially on mainstream media. So I was just like, oh, okay, this is a really interesting group and club, and the people in it too have been great and amazing and very thoughtful. So I just decided to continue with it. So this is my second year within Project Censored.
And Daisy, perhaps just tell them what you'll be doing after you leave.
I actually start naturopathic medical school in the fall. I will be going to Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine in Tempe, Arizona.
Daisy, that's definitely interesting and makes a lot of sense given some of the stories that you have been researching and some that you've looked at. One of the stories is on falsified drug studies that led to millions of children receiving dangerous antidepressants. That's one of the stories. And, of course, couples with some of the other stories that have come from San Francisco State University this year, particularly the crisis in evidence-based medicine that talks about half or more of all medical research may be false, and that was from Stanford University. I mean, that's a very significant and serious story.
Actually, the primary source on that was the lead editor of Lancet.
Yes.
And he came out with that statement and said at least half the drug studies are suspect.
Pretty alarming, particularly looking at the structure and the architecture of Big Pharma and its impact on quote-unquote healthcare.
Well, and Lancet being the leading medical literature publisher in the world, it's quite startling to have the editor say such a thing.
It is. And Daisy, you interested in naturopathic medicine, right? Taking a different path, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the stories that you were looking at? Tell us about them.
The story, I mean, they all said the same thing, but pretty much what it is that there was a study that was done called Study 329, where it said that these antidepressants with the drug paroxetine, also known as Paxil or Seroxat, was generally well tolerated by adolescents. But what they left out was the fact that there was a serious side effect, which included suicide or thoughts of suicide. So they found that 12 out of 93 children would have suicidal thoughts. And a possible reason for that would be the scientific research influenced by pharmaceutical companies in these clinical trials. So they found that pharmaceutical companies were 22 times less likely to report negative statements about the drug compared to companies that were independently funded. And I guess that would increase it as well. I know in the crisis in evidence-based medicine, they talked about how evidence-based medicine is hijacked by commercial interests, and doctors use these research to inform or make their medical decisions, whether it's prescribing drugs to their patient or giving surgeries. So for them to go off of that, I know, has that kind of effect on what we take now today and just contributes to that increasingly misdiagnosis that's going on because of their role.
So certainly we're looking here at vested interest by major drug companies, and they do studies, but they leave out the negative side of it. Oh,
yeah.
By the way, kids might commit suicide, but it gets massively used, and they make big profit. So you're saying that we really should seriously look into this to a greater extent. That's certainly what the story said.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you had another story. Tell us about that.
I did. I had a story called Tapping Our Social Nature for Health and Survival, and I was a co-researcher with another friend of mine named Dorsa. We're interns together. But pretty much it talks about our sense of belonging and how it's a basic need that we have and how we're so disconnected because of technology and our commercially driven society. But I guess she talks about places that continue break these disconnects. So places that have like community gardens and community schools where they incorporate academic institution as well as extracurricular activities. So just working with that. And I feel like I can resonate with that because I feel just growing up, you always want a place to belong and struggling with that, especially when you feel like you have to fit a certain bubble based on what society shows you and tells you and how other people are influenced by that. And then their influence, you know, is projected onto you.
So you're talking about health for people.
Yeah.
Social health, and essentially saying that electronic media, or what they call social media now, really isn't social.
Yeah.
Social is two people looking at each other, smiling, nodding their heads, just like we're doing right now.
Exactly.
And getting positive feedback in that way, and that doesn't happen electronically.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't.
We're not very well.
And we're such a social species. I mean, millions of years of food gathering and collaboration around all sorts of things for survival. And we're very tribal as a species that we have, as Daisy was saying, we have a need to belong somewhere. And when that's missing, our health is impacted. And there are all sorts of studies. In fact, her story talks about a UCSF study with over 3,000 nurses all having breast cancer, and it found that those that went through cancer alone were four times more likely to die from the disease than those with 10 or more friends supporting their journey of change.
That's a significant story in its own right. And Ken Burroughs, given your focus, certainly on holistic health journalism and these types of issues, what else can you add to the sort of the collection of a Daisy stories? And especially you've mentioned the Lancet story as, mm-hmm. as being a significant problem, but maybe mm-hmm. counter to that, some other things that you've encountered or that you talk about in classes about these kinds of issues.
Well, it's a broad brush, a broad mm-hmm. question. It varies a lot. There's a complexity that's showing up now in our society, naturally, in this post-postmodern era. And to think holistically, holistic literacy, to develop the skill to really face the complexity of our moment, it's quite humbling. And science is doing its best to approach this, and that's showing up in physics in one place, which is usually the leading science where discoveries happen. And what happens in physics is just because we realize our physical models are not holding. So it's happening at all levels of the food chain of human discovery right now. I'm not sure really where to start to even answer this, but this whole idea of thinking more holistically has become quite essential.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. certainly the conversations you have in your classes, and it's very obvious that the students you have carry that mm-hmm. through a lot of their research. You know, another story that's been making the rounds again recently from last year was medical malpractice being the third leading cause of death. And the CDC totals, they seem to be sitting on that. They don't seem to want to really be addressing that. But that also goes back to the Lancet report and the fact that this is profit-driven. This is not necessarily science-driven. It's almost scientism wrapped in capitalism. Comment on that challenge that we really face.
Well, with a profit-based model, I grew up in an era, Peter and I both grew up in a time when it was socially pathological to want to make profit off of illness. Hospitals were named after saints, typically. People volunteered in them. It was a very different healthcare system. And now we're looking at something that is owned by big consortiums. And if they're not making enough profit, they'll close the hospital down. So we're not getting the preventive treatment we need. We're not getting the education we need. And we're certainly not getting complementary and alternative care in those systems. So there's a great struggle going on in these dialogues about how to improve not just healthcare, but our ways of staying healthy before we get sick in a system that might make us even sicker.
And even Ken Burroughs redefining and reimagining what that means mm-hmm. to be healthy and socially. And I know this has come up before, and this is now mm-hmm. here we are again. They mentioned the nurses and the cancer patients that were with groups were doing right. better. It's also the case we live in such a technologically driven society, and we have so much screen time, right? Yeah. Rather than Facebook, not FaceTime, right? And we don't have, and this is radio, it's a conversation, right? But I mean, we have people in this room, we have people talking and sharing about these stories, we can see each other. That does seem to make a difference.
A huge difference. And this is, again, where generative journalism could step in and start asking questions that would get us to think about possibilities and not just about what's not working. So this generation of possibilities is, I think, what the millennials is really beginning to approach, is how do we look at a very different system here? And we need, therefore, a journalism that allows that to catalyze.
Well, Daisy, you're going into naturopathic medicine. Will you speak to that? What was driving you toward that model? And what do you have to say about what we're discussing here with Ken?
Long story short, my mom had breast cancer. It was the summer before I started at SF State. So I spent months with her in the hospital, and I was just kind of watching the patient care she was getting, and I didn't really appreciate it as much. And then after the fact she had passed, I saw the drug that they'd given her was recalled. And that's when I was like, oh, no. Because before I came in with the intention of going into the pharmaceutical company and all that. So just since then, that shied me away from that. And I think Ken came into my class the first semester I started and talked about holistic health. And I didn't know that things existed. So I checked out their library, the Learning Center. And I enjoyed the books, immunotherapy. I was especially drawn to the cancer sections given that time of her mom passing away. And I was just like, oh my gosh, there's other forms, to heal her that they don't really tell you while you're in the hospital or they don't let you know about. So I was like, okay, maybe somehow I could work with plants more versus mm-hmm. actual chemicals when it comes to healing people. So I spent one summer, I was researching, and then naturopathic mm-hmm. medicine came up and I was like, huh. This is interesting. And then I looked at their principles in which they approach patients, and I really enjoyed that they were very educating in terms of educating their patients in their diseases and causes and how to deal with that. And it was very non-invasive, which is also what I appreciated, because I watched my mom get poked and prodded, and it wasn't fun for me to to see that. I didn't enjoy it, so that was disheartening. I don't want other people to have to go through that same thing too, which is my main reason for going into it, like a way to help others without hurting them in the process. So.
Well, Daisy, that's some serious trials and tribulations, you know, for such a young person to have to experience and endure. But clearly that wasn't lost on you. It's been a very driving force in who you are in the world and who you're going to be as you move forward. Thank you for sharing those stories with us.
Thank you.
Ken Burrows, we want to also bring in another student, and we want to continue this conversation about the significance of critical media literacy, the work of the Project Censored Affiliate Group at San Francisco State University. I'd like to remind people that you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Helf with Peter Phillips. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. To the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we've been looking at the importance of critical media literacy education. We've been focusing on the San Francisco State University affiliates of Project Censored, led by a faculty member, Ken Burrows. We've been hearing from a lot of Ken's students today, and we're going to finalize this program with this segment with another student. Jillian Solomon joins us to talk about the stories that she's been researching for the Censored 2017 cycle. And Jillian Solomon, tell us a little bit about yourself and your path in education and how you got involved with the project.
I started at San Francisco State University in the fall. I recently changed my major to Environmental Studies, Social Justice, and I actually became involved with Project Censored through Ken Burrows' class and was drawn to Project Censored because we research stories that aren't being shared in public media, and I found it important that we are able to share stories that are of much importance and everyone should be aware of and informed.
Then riffing off of that, why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple of the stories that you have been researching. The couple that we have here on the projectcensored.org site are We Must Speak Up, Capitalism is Eating Democracy. There's another story you have on India's solar plans that are actually being blocked by the World Trade Organization. So why don't you pick one of those and let's talk a little bit about the stories, your research, and your thoughts.
I'll start with the India's solar mission plan that was blocked by the World Trade Organization. I was interested in this story because I found it really interesting how current international trade rules limit our government's capacity to support local renewable energy, and it undermines our clean technologies for social betterment.
Well, certainly this is a World Trade Organization. This is a neoliberal kind of story, and the World Trade Organization is a big component of the movement toward globalization, right? And when we hear the word globalization, when we don't have political analysis and theory behind it, we hear, oh, we're all working together. We're all going to be a big, happy global village and family. And what it turns out globalization and neoliberal economics actually is it's not free trade. It's certainly not fair trade, but it's free trade in the sense that, well, those with money and capital are free to trade how they like against the sovereignty of other peoples. And in the case of India, this sounds like a story where there are plans in a very densely populated country to go to renewable energy, but yet the forces of global capitalism are saying, well, not so fast.
It's interesting, especially with India, I mean, looking from a colonization standpoint, they're just now trying to step up and come up. And it's interesting how the U.S. still has power over them and can come in and rule against it. India relies solely on burning of coal for their energy, which is detrimental for climate change, and it would be nice for them to pursue this solar mission, which would give renewable energy and build their economy by creating local jobs. This plan would have brought energy to millions of people, generating 100 gigawatts of solar energy annually by 2022. These trade agreements can create opportunities for American businesses and help growth in the U.S. economy. However, these developing countries are suffering the most from these trade agreements.
Yeah, this is certainly a very important story, and it's certainly not the only one of its type. This is happening in many places around the world, and the corporate news media in the U.S. are oft, well, let's just say that they engage in foot-dragging or stonewalling, huh? They don't really leap to cover these kind of stories. Ken Burroughs, can we bring you back in a little bit? You oversee some of the research of these stories. What's your take on this kind of a story?
Well, this has a lot to do with trade agreements. The WTO was active, in, along with the United States, in blocking this. And around the world, if we were to create a kind of journalistic system that would track this in an honest way, we'd be really exploring with good critical thought, is this kind of trade really in our benefit? It certainly is not in the benefit of slowing down global warming if countries were trying to do something really right as far as a national plan and something to empower their cities and their workers, and it's blocked because of a synthetic trade agreement.
Indeed. There was a BBC report about this, and it was also in the Huffington Post. Again, but these kinds of stories don't seem to get, right? They don't seem to get the big coverage because of the corporate media's connection and shareholder connection to the big banks and the global economy.
Right. And her second story, I think, is even more clear about why that is. Would you like to mention a little bit about that? I'm glad to speak to it as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, Jillian, please tell us about that. One of the other stories you did, which actually has a quite catchy title, We Must Speak Up, Capitalism is Eating Democracy. And that's something that's been a recurring theme and certainly critics of that system for a long time. Tell us a little bit about that, Jillian.
I was inspired by Yanis Varoufakis. I was diving deep into his interviews about how we must reclaim our democracy and how capitalism...
The finance minister from Greece, for listeners that don't know, right?
Yes.
Who spoke here not long ago. But please tell us more about your diving into this.
What caught my interest was how our capitalist society is run. Mostly I'm speaking on behalf of monopoly capitalism and how a very small percentage of wealth have the power over policies and can influence our government. It's quite interesting to see how these economic and political spheres have been separated at the start of our country, and now you're starting to see it in more of the economic sphere, and we need to reclaim our government back to a democracy to speak for the people's behalf and our social needs and interests, not only capitalism, to benefit all of us. We're starting to see a huge inequality between the wealth and the poor, and capitalism is a big influential part in this. The rise in unemployment is a global consequence of this economic growth.
So you're saying that private capital, so concentrated in the world that less than 1% owns well over half, hundreds of trillions of dollars, actually, and that they will stop or block creative things like solar panels in India. And we had a story earlier about synthetic diesel fuel from air and water, which I can't imagine the petroleum companies are going to do anything but try to prevent from happening on any sort of large scale. So these are things that are vital for people to understand and know, I would imagine.
It's really important to just be educated in what's going on and what's really pushing these policies.
Jillian, what attracted you to this story? I mean, what attracted you to reading about the Greek finance minister? I mean, I'm actually fascinated about what piqued your interest about going into that route. I mean, that doesn't seem like leisurely reading, right?
even for
a lot of college students, right? What attracted you to that? I mean, granted, you know, it says here in this piece, we have it posted, by the way, at projectcensor.org, We Must Speak Up, Capitalism is Eating Democracy. It says capitalism without democratic oversight can become a very uncivilized system, brutish, destructive. It threatens the global economy and environment. certainly we've done scores of stories on those issues, you know, over the years. But tell us a little bit about that. A, what kind of drew you to the story? And B, back to generative journalism and Ken Burroughs and what Brandi Miceli was talking about. What do you think we can do about some of these things that are going on that you're learning about?
What drew me to this story was how capitalism is affecting all areas of our life. Being an environmental studies major, social justice, I start to see a trend on how capitalism can be looked at as the underlying root cause to a lot of our issues in terms of job loss, suffering. We see it with cutting of government spending, and it's just harder for people to get by. Healthcare is more expensive, and it's as if you don't have the money, then you don't have the opportunities that someone else does with wealth. It's interesting to see how capitalism can work and to look into different routes that we could take to make capitalism work with social needs and not just for a small percentage of people who can benefit. We also have to look at people who are not benefiting and take that into consideration, considering that there's a higher percentage of people who are not benefiting from the system.
Indeed, and, you know, upwards of half the population of the globe, you know, certainly living in varying degrees of poverty, even in the United States, which is commonly overlooked. We have these mythic perceptions of how people are doing, but, you know, upwards of 30-40% of people are hand-to-mouth in the United States, and people don't seem to get much of a voice. They're certainly not being represented by the Hillary Clintons and Donald Trumps of the world in the U.S.
Well, not only this mountain of debt that you're talking about for the poor, but this mountain of idle profit for the wealthy. And his point, I think, in this article, and she's done a very good job writing up the story, it's very well done, this that the investment from the wealthy is not returning. The cycle is not being completed. So it's not being returned to the culture right now. The instability of this moment is growing, and people can see the debt mounting.
What we've seen from the Panama Papers even very recently.
So they're putting it offshore and, you know, stepping out of taxes and everything else. And they're not really responsibly investing back into community. And so this cycle, her article points out very well. I have a wonderful line here. The result is low wages and unemployment for more than a quarter of 25 to 54-year-olds in America, Japan, and Europe. They're out of work. And consequently, the aggregate demand, the cycle that reinforces investment is reversed, and so culture is being highly impacted. And green technologies that could be highly financed right now are not happening, in part because of this cycle of lack of investment and unemployment everywhere.
And it's a growing trend.
The concentration of capital, and we're really talking about $100 trillion, is managed by these big BlackRock and Barclays, these big money management banks and firms that are looking for 7-8% return on investment for their investors. And these are the hundreds of thousands of millionaires and billionaires who are putting their money in these concentrated places. It's primarily speculative. So they're looking for areas where home values are going up or land prices or water shortages. It's entirely speculative, but it's not regenerative in the sense of building giant plants to create synthetic diesel fuel.
And they're holding back from investments that are somewhat risky and they're really needed. So
that speculation is driving us so far ahead that it's inevitably going to be the bubble that will burst and capitalism will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's inevitable in that sense. Many people are writing about this.
Jillian, you want to jump back in here?
I just want to say that an observation is that capitalism is very wasteful. It's, with it being in the hands of such a small percentage, it encourages them to fly private jets and create more of a carbon imprint. It's really important to look at it in a different perspective, not just with self-absorbed needs and how you can come up and make more, and not really taking into consideration other people who don't even have food or have food rationing in other underdeveloped countries.
Or other species, or the ecosystem.
It affects everything.
Yeah, so capitalism in many ways is so antithetical to a lot of our natural systems here. I mean, we're dealing with ocean acidification. In 15 years, we might have some massification in the Pacific Ocean. The coral reef is largely bleached. These are the challenges that millennials are really going to face. I mean, we're going to face it too. And the older generation of people are going to, you know, they're still part of that system, right? And, you know, there really is, again, I want to go back to where we started with this and not just the generative journal. journalism idea, but reimagining these types of systems, right?
And how they can work.
Yes.
Definitely.
Well, he's a wonderful man to do that because he's both a libertarian and a Marxist. He's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, like the anarcho-syndicalist elements, yeah, the right-left paradigm.
He's quite interesting that way. And he's suggesting that the problem is not just capitalism, it's unfettered capitalism. Mm-hmm. Really don't have a democracy that's balancing out the dark side of capitalism.
And Robert Reich has a recent book talking about this. Certainly Ralph Nader has talked about this for years in one of his recent books on transcending the right-left paradigm. Very important way of sort of, again, reimagining, rethinking, retooling, and just restarting a lot of these things. Instead of reforming, right, where we inherit so many of the built-in flaws, in many cases that needs to be deconstructed. We need to start anew. And
it's
I think
a clean slate.
Yeah. I think so. And I think what's so exciting about a lot of this is, with this kind of critical media literacy kind of project, with a lot of the project-centered stories, is that we get to hear from young people. We get to hear your creativity, your ideas, what you think is important, and what you're doing about it, right? Not just what you're talking about in Ken's class, but what you're going to do about it. And you're an environmental
studies
major. Social
justice.
So what do you see yourself – that's a great connection. So what do you see yourself doing with this?
I see myself – my inner self is an activist, self-proclaimed. I try to take anything I can into my own hands and sign petitions and be politically active and also get my friends involved. I feel like us millennials really need to start stepping up to the plate and start caring about things that actually matter and affect us directly or indirectly. We all are connected, and if it's not directly affecting us now, it most definitely inevitably will.
Well, that is certainly well put. And the stories, of course, that we have heard today, Ken Burrows, from your students have once again been quite remarkable. Ken Burrows, we're going to wrap up this segment here. We have a minute left. Can you just give us maybe some concluding thoughts on your part?
Well, it's great to be here. I'm pleased to be behind the mic again. It's a rare challenge to really organize thoughts. I'm appreciating what you do here on the radio program, just stepping up to the mic again. It's a noble effort, and just to hold this community conversation and deepen it is a great thing, I hope, for the listeners as well.
Well, we certainly appreciate you being here and the efforts at San Francisco State University. Jillian Adazy, thank you so much for coming in and joining us along with Michael and Brandy. We've had a great session here, and we're very delighted that you came on and shared this information. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. We'll certainly be updating these stories.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
That does it for the Project Censored show today on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Helf with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. American Nuremberg. The U.S. officials who should stand trial for post 9/11 war crimes. An interview with Rebecca Gordon. To this day, the people of the United States have no accounting of what has been done in our names in the so-called War on Terror. But we're left with ongoing misery for literally millions of people. Destabilized regions in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, North Africa, and blowback and spillover into Europe. And it is extraordinary how a small group of political leaders could have created such ongoing expanding devastation and has not been held responsible in any way. Rebecca Gordon writes that for the sake of the victims of the war on terror, we need real accountability for American war criminals. Her book, American Nuremberg, published by Hot Books at Skyhorse, New York City, went into distribution in April 2016. If you are a longtime listener to TUC Radio, you occasionally hear rebroadcasts of programs produced by my colleague, Jeffrey Blankford. He's a well-known photographer, longtime activist, and host of a radio program on foreign policy, Takes on the World. In June 2016, he interviewed our mutual friend, Rebecca Gordon, on KZYX Radio in Philo, California. This is Jeff Blankford.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Gordon once again to Takes on the World.
Jeffrey, it's a joy to be with you.
Your book really, really impressed me and was so timely. And it begins with an eloquent moving forward of how you came to write American Nuremberg. And I'd like you to share some of that with our listeners.
I was just hanging out in my usual life, teaching ethics to young people, when I got an email last March from David Talbot, who is the author, many people probably know him best as the author of Season of the Witch. So this is a well-known book. So David Talbot is also one of the original founders of Salon.com. So I had certainly heard of him, and this email arrived in my mailbox saying, I want you to write a book, and here's the title, American Nuremberg. And I was thrilled to have somebody actually ask me to write a book, but I was not happy with the title. And the reason why is that I'm a child of the 1950s. My parents lived through World War II. My father was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home in Norfolk, Virginia, and I grew up understanding that really if there was one symbol of the depth of evil to which human beings could fall, it was the barbarism that enveloped Europe, that supposedly civilized continent, in the mid-20th century that began with the Nazis. That was the Nazi rise to power, the Holocaust. At the end of World War II, somewhere between 65 and 80 million people around the world had died. And so, terrible as I think the crimes that my country has committed in this so-called war on terror, they are nothing on the same scale as the crimes that people were put on trial for at Nuremberg. And so for people who might not remember, Nuremberg is the name of a city in Germany, and it's the place where the four victors in World War II, that would be Great Britain, France, the United States, and the Soviet Union, came together to put on trial a number up to, in the end, 200 high officials in the German Nazi government and some of the people in civilian life who had assisted them. But the most famous trials were the first ones, in which 22 people were put on trial. 19 of them were convicted. 3 of them were acquitted. And this is what we mean when we say Nuremberg. And it was the first time something really important historically happened at Nuremberg. It was really the first time in human history that internationally the nations of the world came together and said the actions of the people leading this particular nation have violated the laws and customs of war. They are wrong. And rather than simply taking what was called victor's justice, in other words, just lining up against a wall and shooting them, they said, we are going to actually put together a tribunal. We're going to put together a trial. We're going to have rules. We're going to have specific crimes that people are being tried for. They're going to have defense attorneys. We're going to have prosecutors. And we are going to put the international mark on justice and say international law is real law. And when you break international law on a scale like this, there are real consequences. So I came to be more comfortable with the title American Nuremberg, which is about people in the U.S. government who are responsible for 3 different kinds of crimes, which I can talk about in a minute, in this thing that seems to be this never-ending war on terror.
Well, it was actually, what didn't Dick Cheney call it, enduring freedom?
Enduring freedom, right. Enduring freedom to have surveillance, enduring freedom to have your email and your internet activity and your phone calls monitored, enduring freedom to destroy nation after nation after nation. So, you know, let's count them up. There's Afghanistan to start with, which, by the way, did not attack us on September 11th, although there were people who were part of al-Qaeda, which was responsible for attacking us on September 11th, including the head of their organization, Osama bin Laden, who were resident in Afghanistan. There were actually offers to turn them over to the U.S. in return for certain things, but the U.S. preferred a military response. So, Afghanistan. Then there was Iraq. Then there was Libya, and now, although we didn't start the civil war in Syria, we are certainly helping it to continue, and we should not forget the country of Yemen, where the United States is currently involved in a war with our ally Saudi Arabia. And this is particularly ironic because in Yemen, we are essentially fighting on the same side as al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula against a group of tribal people called the Houthi, who happen to be Shia Muslims, as opposed to al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia, where the vast majority of people are Sunni Muslims. So the U.S. has responded to one set of terrible attacks with wars in multiple countries on multiple continents. And I think that the people who are responsible for this, and of course for what we call extraordinary rendition, basically kidnapping people and sending them to other countries to be tortured, or kidnapping people and torturing them ourselves. I believe that these things are various kinds of really important crimes, and that those crimes, there needs to be justice for those crimes.
There has hardly been an anti-war movement protesting them, but before the war, there was a significant movement. And the irony, of course, is the protest was exemplified by electing Barack Obama to the presidency and sweeping Democrats into the control of both the Senate and the House. But immediately Barack Obama said that instead of looking backward, we are going to look forward. And Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, also said essentially the same thing. And instead of having an investigation, even a minimum investigation like Britain did about its role getting into the Iraq War, nothing happened here. There was something that took place in a basement in Washington. But in terms of public demand for an accounting, it didn't happen.
No, that's absolutely right. And so the day that he came into office, President Obama signed executive orders that closed the CIA's black sites. This is what they call them. These were the secret torture centers that they had in Thailand and Poland, Romania, on the British island of Diego Garcia. They also had their own black site that was separate from the military, from the Defense Department in Guantanamo, in Guantanamo Bay. And he ordered those closed, and he also ordered that the use of what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, what ordinary people with an ordinary dictionary would call torture, that those should end. But you're exactly right. At the same time, he made this public announcement that we need to look forwards, not backwards. Now, my personal belief, and this is, I don't have a lot of evidence or any really to back this up, but I think that one thing that happened is that when he came into office, he also discovered the power of a permanent national security establishment, a national security state, and that there were limits to the power even of the President of the United States in facing that establishment, and that this was something of a quid pro quo, that yes, the CIA would agree to shut down these places and stop torturing people if they really did it, and, you know, we only have their word for it, but we can hope, and in return, there would be no prosecutions. And I think also, to be perfectly fair, that part of what he discovered was not only there are limits to the presidency, but those limits are much greater when the president happens to be a black man. Nonetheless, the result has been that nobody has been prosecuted, nobody has been held accountable in any public way for a series of different kinds of crimes. And in the book, I divide them into three sort of categories, kind of following what they did at Nuremberg. So the first one is war crimes, and that's something that the world was familiar with. There was already a big body of international law and custom about how wars should be conducted, what kinds of things violated that, including ways that prisoners couldn't be treated and so forth. But the other two categories were new. One of them is called crimes against humanity. And those are crimes that are committed in the context of a war, in the context of also committing war crimes, which involve the elimination, the destruction, or the mass deportation or movement of an entire group of people based on ethnicity, like the Jews, based on level of physical or mental ability, like disabled people, based on sexual orientation, like the LGBT people who were also killed by the Nazis, or the Roma people who were also killed by the Nazis. These were the crimes against humanity. But the United States and Britain argued very forcefully for the first crime, the crime that they said was the root of all the other crimes, and a lot of people don't remember this, which was the crime against peace. In other words, the idea that if you have international law against invading another country, and if you have, as Germany had and as the U.S. has, signed a treaty saying you will not invade another country unless you have been first attacked by that country, that crime against peace, that creating the initial war, was what the British and the Americans argued was the wellspring of all the other crimes. And we forget, we think, you know, Nazi Germany, the Holocaust, but most of the people who died in the Holocaust didn't die inside Germany. They died in occupied Poland. So it's the invasion of Austria, of Poland, of Czechoslovakia that begins all the rest of the crimes. You can't have war crimes without a war. And so as I was thinking about how the U.S. has behaved since September 11th, since those terrible attacks, one of the things that I realized is that we have been horrified, and properly so, and I wrote a whole book about it, by the torture that the U.S. has been involved in. And, you know, we had had a period since the end of the Vietnam War in which we more or less believed about ourselves that that's something we don't do. We may teach other countries how to do it at the School of the Americas, but we don't do it ourselves. And that, of course, all changed after September 11th. So we've really been focused on the torture, which is terrible. But we missed the bigger crime. and the crime that really in the beginning was responsible for the torture, and that's the invasion of Iraq. And the reason I say that is when they first started torturing people, the very first people who were waterboarded, the very first people who were given the treatment that Donald Rumsfeld approved in Guantanamo that included sleep deprivation, stress positions, using dogs to terrify people, all of those kinds of things, those were all for the purpose of getting somebody somewhere to say that Saddam Hussein was in some way in cahoots with al-Qaeda and that Saddam Hussein, the then head of the Iraqi government, was responsible for September 11th. And of course, it wasn't true. But they took a man named Abu Zubaydah. They exposed him to what they call the waterboard. And, you know, waterboarding has been described in the media as simulated drowning. But there's nothing simulated about it. It's plain old drowning. And they did this to him 83 times. Well, you do that to anyone, and they'll tell you whatever it is you want to hear. And by the way, this Abu Zubaydah is a very interesting story. He's actually from Saudi Arabia. He is the person that every time somebody said, well, why do you have to do this torture? Why do you have to use these enhanced interrogation techniques? This was the man that Donald Rumsfeld turned to, that George W. Bush turned to, that Dick Cheney turned to, and said, see, this is why. So Donald Rumsfeld said he was the number two man or very close to the number two man in al-Qaeda. George W. Bush said he was one of Osama bin Laden's top lieutenants. Later on, Bush also added, and Cheney went along with this, that he was running a training camp in Afghanistan where five of the original hijackers on September 11th were trained. So this was one of the really bad guys, as Bush used to like to say, and they had to torture him because he was so bad. Well, it turns out the main reason they were torturing him was to get him to say something about Saddam Hussein. But it also turns out that none of this was true. The prime example of why they had to torture, it was all lies. And in fact, it's true. He did run a training camp in Afghanistan because he was a CIA asset when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan in the 1980s. He was training the Mujahideen, who were the Islamic fighters who were trying to throw out the Soviet Union occupation. He was one of Ronald Reagan's freedom fighters. And, of course, the Mujahideen eventually became the Taliban that the U.S. declared war on. And the Taliban ran Afghanistan in a horrible way, and it was particularly horrible for women. And I hold no brief for the Taliban, but they were actually the legitimate, at one time, U.S.-supported government of Afghanistan when we attacked them. So he had run this camp. The camp was called Khaldun. And here's how the CIA did the logical loop. Because he was running this camp, and he was known to be a lieutenant of al-Qaeda, then Khaldun must be an al-Qaeda training camp. Because he ran an al-Qaeda training camp, he must be a high member of al-Qaeda. So it was a complete logical circle that wasn't true. So the reason we know it's not true is that in 2009, now under the Obama administration, Abu Zubaydah's lawyers were presenting a case for what's called habeas corpus. That basically means, hey, government, you have this person's body. Tell us why you are holding him. So they have been suing the government for years to find out why he was being held in Guantanamo. Because once the CIA was done with him, they shipped him off to Guantanamo with a memo saying he should never again in his life have substantial or substantive contact with a human being, that he should be kept incommunicado for the rest of his life. So his lawyers are trying to find out, well, what did he do? So in the process, they're saying, well, you're claiming that he did this, you know, that he was a al-Qaeda lieutenant, that he trained these people for 9/11, that maybe he knew something about the Millennium Bomb plot in 2000, that he helped Osama bin Laden escape from Afghanistan. You're claiming all of this. Show us the papers. Show us the proof. And so the government filed a brief in reply in which they said, we don't have to show you any papers because guess what? We're no longer claiming that he was in al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he was ever even a member of al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he ran an al-Qaeda training camp. We're no longer claiming that he had anything to do with September 11th. So they withdrew every single reason why they're holding him, and yet the case drags on, and he is still in Guantanamo. So all of which is to say that the crime, the birth crime, if you will, was the desire to invade Iraq. And in fact, Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and his neoconservative cabal came into the White House with a plan to do exactly that. It's the same plan that they had tried to sell back in 1992 to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, and it was called a clean break. And then they formed an organization, and there were about 20 of these people, including Khalilzad and Elliot Abrams, who some of you may remember from Central America days, and Paul Wolfowitz, and they...
Don't forget Richard Perle.
Right, absolutely, Richard Perle.
The Black Prince.
And they brought a whole bunch of these people. Dick Cheney brought them along with him into the White House, and they tried to sell the same plan to Bill Clinton in 1996 under the guise of an organization called the Project for a New American Century. And the plan was basically a plan to destabilize and then remake the Middle East along lines that would be more in keeping with U.S. strategic interests. So the first step was get rid of Saddam Hussein and open up the Iraqi oil fields to U.S. oil companies. Next was destabilize Syria, replace the Assad regime. In those days, it was Bashar Assad's father, but replace the Assad regime with somebody that we like better. Now, we liked Assad well enough to send him a Canadian named Maher Arar in 2003 to be tortured for 10 months. But nonetheless, we suddenly woke up one day and discovered that he runs a police state, which is true. And so we're definitely against Assad now. Destabilize Syria, and then eventually go on to Jordan. Libya was sort of on the side there. But the idea was that we would remake the whole Arab world along lines that were more, oh, and Iran, of course, that were, so not just the Arab world, but the whole Middle East, along lines that would more appeal to U.S. interests. Well, I got to say, these guys were not only pernicious and determined, and they discussed these plans way back in March of 2001, long before September 11th. They were not only determined, but they were stupid. Because the end result is, yeah, they've remade the Middle East into chaos, but the U.S. oil companies didn't end up with most of the contracts in the Iraqi oil fields. So they didn't even get one of their, but not their only, prime objectives. So people don't remember, because September 11th came along and kind of wiped our memories. But way back in March of 2001, the big issue in the country was that Dick Cheney had been put in charge of creating the new energy policy for the United States. And this was the big job that George W. Bush gave him. And he was meeting with all these people. He was holding meetings, secret meetings, in the White House, and nobody could get him to say who he was meeting with to formulate our new energy policy. And in fact, he claimed executive privilege and said, I don't have to tell you who. And CEOs of oil companies went up to Congress, to Capitol Hill, and perjured themselves and said they hadn't met with Dick Cheney when they had met with him 50 times. And what they were doing was laying out the plan to invade Iraq. And so on September 12th, 2001, the day after the attacks, we already see memos from Dick Cheney saying, is there any way we can pin this on Saddam Hussein? So they were already preparing this war that had nothing to do with September 11th, that had nothing to do with any kind of international law, that was in fact a violation of laws and treaties that the United States has signed. And by the way, in the U.S. Constitution, which some of us still fondly remember, in Article 6, it says, if we sign and the Senate ratifies a treaty, that treaty becomes part of the supreme law of the land. It's as if it were any other federal law. It has to be obeyed. That includes the Kellogg-Briand Treaty that we signed way back in 1928, saying we wouldn't attack people who didn't attack us. It also includes the Charter for the United Nations, of which the U.S. is, of course, a founding member and a permanent member on the Security Council. So it includes a lot of treaties. It also, of course, includes the Convention Against Torture, which we signed and ratified.
My guest, by the way, is Rebecca Gordon. This has been informative.
Let's talk about what we could do. War Crimes Tribunal.
Together, right.
So here's the problem. The right place for these people to be tried is either in U.S. courts or the International Criminal Court. But the U.S. is not part of the International Criminal Court. We love it when they try African leaders there. But under Bush, they actually withdrew the signature, and Congress passed a law making it illegal for anybody to assist the trying of any U.S. person in the International Criminal Court. So that's out. In fact, they even said that if somebody is on trial there, the army should go in and rescue them. Some people called it the Invade the Hague Law. So that's out. The chances that we're going to see prosecutions here in the United States, there are plenty of things they could do. The likelihood that Hillary Clinton or God knows Donald Trump is going to do that are very, very slim, in fact, nil. So in a way, that kind of throws it back on us. And I look back to the model that Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell in Europe did in 1967 when they tried the United States government in a people's tribunal for war crimes in the Vietnam War. And these were held over a series of days in Europe. I think what we need is a people's tribunal. And I think we need to bring together people, ideally people of a variety of political stripes, but who believe in the rule of law, as I do, and people who have been victims of the war on terror in various ways, and to have a serious airing. Because the people I know who work with victims of torture and war especially, all of them say that the number one thing that people want in order to feel that they have had justice is for their story to be heard and publicly acknowledged. And so I think that if we can't get an official government acknowledgement, we need a people's acknowledgement of what has been done and sadly is still being done in our names as the people of this still nominally democratic country.
That was Rebecca Gordon, author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. The book was published by Skyhorse New York via its imprint, Hot Books. Rebecca Gordon teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Her prior book, Mainstreaming Torture, was based on her PhD thesis in ethics and social theory at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union, in Berkeley, California. Rebecca Gordon was interviewed by activist, photographer, and radio host Jeffrey Blankford on June 22, 2016. And my thanks go out to my friends Rebecca and Jeffrey and to KZYX Radio in Philo, California, for this extraordinary interview. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the goal, you see, of indigenous education, as was reflected in the poem, was to find your face, find your heart, find your foundation in these relationships and responsibilities, concentric relationships and responsibilities, towards the goal of becoming a complete human being.
That's the voice of renowned indigenous author, Dr. Gregory Cayette. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Cayette about his philosophy on indigenous education and society. Dr. Cayette is a publisher of many books, including Look to the Mountain and Ecology of Indigenous Education. So stay tuned.
I have the great privilege of having this morning the author of Look to the Mountain and Ecology of Indigenous Education, Dr. Gregory Cayette. Look to the Mountain is a wonderful book that offers not just educators, but people in general, a remarkable fresh perspective on the challenges facing education in contemporary society. Dr. Cayette is a member of the Tewa peoples from New Mexico. Very privileged to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. I'm really very happy and very honored to have some time to share my thoughts with you.
Now, you've written about an ecology of indigenous education. Tell us what inspired you to write this book. What is the hope in writing this book?
Primarily, it's a book that is, I guess you might say, a product of both, I would say, creative anger would be one way to describe, one emotion that went into writing this book. I work at that time at a school called the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the school basically is a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. It's one of three post-secondary schools. And in this case, the Institute of American Indian Arts is dedicated to using the arts primarily as a foundation for training young aspiring Native people in the vocation of art in a variety of areas. So it's it of its very nature was a very early on a kind of leader in culturally based arts education. So I was a teacher there. I'm also a self-taught artist, and during that time I was really the school was involved or embroiled, as will happen with many issues related to its literally its existence. And at that time, it was being slated to be closed. And we had gone through a major effort through the Congress, because the school actually is a line item within the federal budget. It's a federally chartered school, one of just a few in the country. And we were being slated to be basically erased from the budget, and so it was a very traumatic time. We had come out of that. They had allowed the school to remain open and reorganized it. It had to change in a very significant way from being an indigenous school to being a school that reflected essentially the Western idea or concept of education. And of course, many of us teaching at the school at that time were very passionate and committed to the school and to the idea of creating an indigenous school around indigenous arts. And so we felt that we had been in a sense compromised in a very significant way with the new legislation. So even though we did remain open, and and the institute is still open today and getting lots and lots of money from various sources, it lost something during that time. And so it was a passion that then led me to begin to write, what is the ecology of indigenous education? I had been working on what is called a culturally relevant or culturally based education science education curriculum, which I had introduced at the school at that time, which integrated science with art, with the cultural perspectives of the students coming from throughout the United States, you know, to the school too. So based on that, also I had to go into really answering the question, what is indigenous education, or what is education for indigenous people? How did we practice this process of education in pre-Columbian times? You know, what was our epistemology, if you will, of education? So that's what led me essentially to explore, to research, and to write the book, Look to the Mountain. So that's kind of, you know, brief, you know, the story of how I wrote it. Let me just finish by saying that the term Look to the Mountain is actually it's an English translation of a Tewa metaphor. We're surrounded by four sacred mountains here in New Mexico where I live, and in my village, which is Santa Clara Pueblo, which is one of six Tewa-speaking pueblos north of Santa Fe. We have various sacred mountains, you know, that sort of encompass or sort of bound, you know, our territory. And so elders will sometimes come up, and especially as we're discussing different kinds of issues that affect the community as a whole, you know, I remember some elders using the term Look to the Mountain, you know, which is basically telling the people, look to your history, you know, where you come from, because you, as you climb a mountain, you go through a process of going through the foothills and climbing to the top of the mountain. And then when you're on top of the mountain, you have another perspective, which is your present. And then as you look out from the top of the mountain, you know, to the other mountains and other valleys around you, you have a vision of possibilities of where to go next. So it's past, present, and future coming together in that act of journeying, you know, to the mountain. And so it's a way of understanding perspective about what you are discussing or what you're reflecting on. And so I use that metaphor, you know, very specifically to reflect on what is indigenous education, what does that mean, what did that mean to us in the past, what does it mean to us in the present, and what are the possibilities, what is the vision of indigenous education for the future? And so that's basically Look to the Mountain, and that's the metaphor that I used.
That's a beautiful metaphor. I just want to borrow on something you mentioned, and that is that creative anger, because in your book you speak about mythopoetic, and I want to talk about the myths. You know, there are myths in our society that not only create how we see the world, but how we engage in the world. And one has been that education is a neutral force, and it takes that stance in relation to colonization. It takes the stance that colonization is something that happened long ago, and it's, you know, we're in a post-colonial society now. So I want to speak about, from a perspective of the Maya people, the Aymara people, the Ojibwe, Haida, the Tewa people, to me it seems that process continues today. I wonder, could you talk about what has been the legacy of education in the colonization process, and what stories of this sad history must be remembered today?
Well, I have to say emphatically that education is not neutral, nor has it ever been neutral, especially in terms of the way it has been practiced and applied within Western cultural settings. Very definitely, education was a tool of colonization, and really continues to be that in some ways today. I think that one of the struggles that Native people have as a whole has been, you know, to in a sense, endure, if you will, Western education, to find ways to adapt to it without losing themselves. And it's been a very long and tenuous history that Native people have had with education as a whole. And so we're just really, really within this past 50, 60 years have begun to just very much a step-by-step process, regain control, or at least some control of our education and also of our process of education. So it's been a long journey in really just being self-determined and really applying that concept of self-determination to education. But yes, definitely education has never been, for Native people at least, neutral.
So I think of the stories that frame that discussion, though, and where are our stories? What are the stories that we must be remembering and retelling?
Well, in the book, Look to the Mountain, as I researched this question, what is Indigenous education? And, of course, the philosophical term that is used for this process of learning culturally is epistemology, which is a fancy philosophical term, but basically it means how do you come to know what you know? How do you come to know what you know? And so you see, every human cultural group has had a philosophy, a vision, if you will, an understanding of how they collectively come to know what they know, which is the epistemology. So, for example, in order to create the kinds of curriculum that I was creating at the Institute at that time, I had to understand, first of all, what is our own history of Indigenous education? What is our epistemology? Because unless you understand that, you don't really have a truly culturally based or culturally relevant curriculum that you can begin to build from. So as I was looking, really looking and researching all over the world and trying to find some kind of a handle, if you will, that I could use a story or a case that sort of exemplify what Indigenous epistemology was, I happened on a very old work that was being done in the early 60s by a gentleman whose name is Miguel Leon Portillo. And he worked, I believe, out of the University of Texas, Austin. And he wrote a book in the 1960s called Aztec Thought and Culture. And in that, he was exploring, what the Aztecs believed education was. And so there's a poem in there, because he was using basically translations from Nahuatl to Spanish into English and looking at different kinds of remnants of poems, that had survived the burning of the libraries in Mexico City at that time. And he found a poem that sort of, and he characterized it in this way. He said, there was a professor, in one of the colleges, the universities, if you will, of the Aztec. And the question was to the students, the professor's question to the students was, what is it to be a person of knowledge? And the students, and again, all of this is chanted, you see, very much like the Hawaiians and the Maoris, the discourse was chanted, in these ritual poems and ritual prayers. And so the chant was given, what is it to be a person of knowledge? The students go off and come back maybe a few days later, and they have a responsal chant that is basically in a poetic form. And that's what these poems that Miguel Leon Portillo was studying. And so in the chant, from the students back to the professor, they said this, first one must find one's face. One must find one's face, which in our terms today means you have to have a sense of your identity. Then they said one must find one's heart, which is really, in today's education jargon, the affective domain. You have to have a sense of why you're doing something. But it goes much deeper. Finding a heart is really also about finding your own sense of spirit. And then one must find one's foundation. Foundation to stand on, which allows you to most completely reflect your heart and your face. And so foundation in our terms today would be vocation, that kind of work that you would do that would allow you, in a sense, to be completely expressive of who you are as a person. And then that all of that happened in these contexts of relationships and responsibilities. Concentric rings of relationship and responsibility. First, yourself to yourself, yourself to your family, yourself to your clan, yourself to your tribe, yourself to the place from which you come, and then finally yourself to the whole cosmos. And then they said it was towards becoming a complete person, a complete man or woman. So the goal, you see, of indigenous education, as was reflected in the poem, was to find your face, find your heart, find your foundation in these relationships and responsibilities, concentric relationships and responsibilities, towards the goal of becoming a complete human being. And so when I found that, I said, this is the essence of indigenous epistemology, you know, because as you will discover as you study this among different tribes, they have different ways of saying basically the same thing, you know, that one must know oneself, one must have a sense of your spirit or your desire, one has to have foundation that's rooted in a community of relationship and responsibility, and that there's a spiritual aspect that guides you as much as an intellectual, you know, towards this journey, if you will, to the top of the mountain. And so that, I think, really epitomizes for me what indigenous education is. And so knowing that and understanding that, we can then, in a sense, begin to build some, in a sense, in a contemporary education setting, some kinds of curriculum that begin to bring some of these values, these core values, these core orientations out again among students. And you can use different subject areas to do this, of course. And, you know, and before I was at the Institute of American Indian Arts, I was a field biologist. So my area is science, but I'm also an artist. I'm also an indigenous person, so what I started to do was create curriculum that integrated these different aspects of myself, which I know was also true of my students, and bring them together in kind of a cohesive learning map, learning process, which we call curriculum. And so, that's basically that story, that part of the story.
I love that story, but because I think that so much of our world is in pain today, and primarily because of this fragmentation of who we are. You know, our bodies have become just a vehicle that carries our head, one of my professors said. And, you know, we live totally disconnected, not only to ourselves, but also to the people around us. And that, you know, this connection also leads to a distancing of the suffering of others. So our world is in need of healing. In your book, you speak of healing. We live in a world with deep scars where one needs only to look around to see the suffering of war, the result of war, hunger, chronic unemployment. Can we heal a world without first acknowledging the nature of this wound?
Well, definitely, you know, colonization wounds people very deeply and through generations. And so in many ways, what has been happening these past few years, you know, has been a kind of recognition that we are and have been traumatized by colonization, an understanding of that process. And I think that we're finally beginning to now move forward into a new phase of thinking about ourselves in a very different kind of way than we were conditioned to with regard to our own colonization. And so, you know, in earlier days with the boarding school, with the ways in which Native kids were indoctrinated within schools, to forget their culture, forget their language, to forget their history even. And for a period and also for several generations of Native people, that was their experience of education. We've now, I think, turned a corner, especially with in 1974, there was an act called the Indian Self-Determination Act, in which Native people were given the right, in a sense, to create their own schools and also to create their own forms of education, you know, and so that's that then gave the impetus for many Native educators to begin to think about what and how we could actually create a different way of educating ourselves and our students in a way that honored their history, honored their language, honored their traditions, honored their communities. And so that's been a struggle. It's been a long journey. It's still a journey that continues in a variety of different kinds of ways. I call it, at this point in time, the indigenous mind rising. Because what I see as I go around all over the world, basically, and work with indigenous populations around education as a whole or science education, I'm beginning to see that many indigenous peoples, many indigenous cultures are moving towards, in a sense, you know, honoring their past, really recreating or revitalizing their language and their communities, and then also bringing forward education as a tool, not only of decolonizing themselves, but actually making education indigenous once again. And so I think that that's the vision for the future, is the sense that as this process evolves through time among indigenous populations and people, that this is really the goal that indigenous people have for themselves. It's more than, you know, getting a job and fitting into the system, because that was also a phase of Native education. But I think now it's moving, you know, towards this deeper reclaiming and recreating of our indigenous identity, indigenous heritage, you know, through the process of education. And so I know that indigenous scholars, you know, wherever you find them in the world, are very, very much involved with this kind of enterprise these days. So that's my hope, is that, that's the healing of the wound. And it's not only the healing of the wound, but it now, in a sense, is moving into a phase of revitalization and recreation of indigenous culture in a contemporary setting in ways that are appropriate and ways that make sense, but also a renewal, I guess you might say, of indigenous spirituality, indigenous economics, indigenous community, indigenous forms of education, so that we have, in a sense, a way to once again survive and actually even to thrive. Now, of course, you know, the world is in such chaos these days, and so, you know, we have climate change, we have wars, we have poverty, we have, you know, the struggle of economics, if you will. But I still, within that context, the indigenous mind is rising, and I think that especially in the areas of ecology and ecological philosophy, I think that many of the new ecological academics have paid heed and are beginning to build on indigenous-like concepts, you know, within within education and also within within the ecological movement. So I see a lot of hope, you know, at least in that context. But again, indigenous people have to do a lot of the work for themselves if they are also going to be a part of that broader global movement, I guess you might say.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're coming to the end of the interview, but I wonder if you could just leave us with some words of inspiration. What inspires you to continue to struggle against what you just described, all this chaos that surrounds us? What inspires your hope that we can, you know, create a different story? What should that new story of who we can become?
Well, I think, you know, education in its best sense always has to be about visions of a brighter future. And so my hope, you know, in the work that I do, I am a director of Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico, and I've been in that position for 10 years. And so what I'm doing with the students that I'm working with in our degree program is helping them think about, you know, that sense of who we are, our history, have them understand, you know, the issues in a very deep and using research in a way, helping them to understand their present situation. But finally, having them create a context in which they can use that kind of education for engaging a vision of the future. And that vision of the future, I think, really needs to be about a reclaiming of indigenous values globally with regard to how we interact with each other, which is one kind of ecology. It's social ecology in more harmonious and more self-supporting ways or mutually supporting ways. How we engage with our natural environment in a more supportive and ecologically sound way. And how we engage with ourselves spiritually, because I think there's also, you know, part of this issue of the modern dilemma or the in terms of modernity and also, the issues of capitalism, as kind of the underpinning of that modernity, is that we have to begin to create new ways of understanding how we interact with each other around how we develop our forms of economic, our forms of education, our forms of community. So right now I'm really, exploring in my next book. I've written six books, but the seventh book is going to be about pedagogy of indigenous community, very much like Look to the Mountain in some ways. To take a look at ways in which we begin to work with each other in more harmonious and more direct ways, applying indigenous principles from the past, applying the best ideas from the present, and really beginning to forge a different kind of future for our children and for our communities. So my hope is that education can actually become a tool not for indoctrination and for assimilation as it was used in the past for indigenous people, but a tool for transformation and for, truly becoming and finding your face and finding your heart and truly becoming complete human beings once again.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. How can people access your books?
I can be reached at gcajete, and that's just gcajete, @aol.com.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us and for taking the time to talk with us.
Okay, thank you, Sylvia. Have a great day.
That was Dr. Gregory Cayetti. He is the director of the Native American Studies. He's also an author, and his book, Look to the Mountain, is a fantastic and highly recommended book for anyone looking to create transformative change in education or in our communities. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.